and the college degree you want. Listen to this. Now you can go to a college designed for busy working adults. It's University of Phoenix, the nation's largest private accredited university. In most cases, you can earn a bachelor's or master's degree in just 2 to 3 years. To find out how, call 1-800-664-1391. At the University of Phoenix Detroit campus, the small classroom settings are designed for working adults with busy lives. With their efficient learning model, you'll cover more material in less time, going to convenient classes in the evening or on the weekend. At University of Phoenix, you can do this. For a complimentary brochure on degree programs in business, technology, nursing, education, and more, call University of Phoenix now, 1-800-664-1391. Programs vary by campus. Classes are forming, so call now, 1-800-664-1391. That's 1-800-664-1391.
Detroit's Rock Station 101 WRIF and WRIF.com bring you the hottest deals in the Motor City. At WRIF.com, you are only one click away from dining at some of your favorite restaurants for only half price. Dine online and eat for less. Save a ton of money with some of Metro Detroit's best restaurants. Like Clubhouse Tavern, located in the fabulous Fisher Building, offering great food at great prices. Log on to www.wrif.com. You can purchase full-price gift certificates to area restaurants for only half price, but quantities are limited, so you better act fast. For more details, log on to WRIF.com and be sure to check out even more special offers and savings. Like Buddy's Pizza, come into any of Buddy's 9 locations today. Enjoy one of the nation's best pizza places as recognized by the Food Network. Buddy's, Detroit's number one pizza since 1946. Log on today and save at WRIF.com.
Like what you hear on the Riff? Then why not give your Riff Rock a go?
You're listening to the award-winning Night Call, the Riff's phone-in talk show on 101 WRIF Detroit. Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much. Welcome, everybody. Sunday night in Detroit and broadcasting from WRIF all across the world, all across our broadcast area, and via the Internet, of course, nationally and internationally. Welcome to the broadcast, and I think we have to welcome hundreds, perhaps even thousands of new listeners. Now, here's why. The Nation magazine, now The Nation is the oldest weekly magazine in the country. 150 years old or what have you, something like that. What are they on? They usually say the volume number and you can tell what year it's in. Anyway, they have a special issue out. It's on the newsstands now, and it's called Radio Waves. Radio Waves, the new sounds of unmanaged democracy. And talking about how there has been a reaction and finally a response to the domination of talk radio and news radio by the right wing. That finally we're starting to get a voice for the other half or more, it looks like now. Certainly the majority of the population that isn't defined by these right wing wackos that have been able to dominate particularly the AM dial. All right, so it's a very interesting issue, and it looks at a lot of the community broadcasting, a lot of the new liberal networks, and it's a very interesting issue indeed. Full disclosure, I have a half-page ad in it. Well, this was quite a story, I'll tell you. Now, on my website, peterwerby.com, P-E-T-E-R-W-E-R-B-E.com, I said you can click here and you can go to the issue. Well, these issues are put out so far in advance. In fact, I think it says here, printed May 4th, the May 23rd issue. So I just went into Paperbacks Unlimited in Ferndale today and got a copy of it because I hadn't seen it yet. And already the May 30th edition is already on the Nation website. You go to thenation.com. So the only way you're going to read this issue is go to your local newsstand and pick it up, the May 23rd edition. In fact, let me see, the 16th, what's the date now? I've lost track totally. But the one before it is barely out of date, right? Somewhere I have a operations log. Let me see. This will tell me. Oh, yeah. So it's, the one that's currently out isn't even out of date till tomorrow. So these things get put out way, way in advance. But it's The Nation. It's Radio Waves. It's a special edition. And I want to thank the people there for the ad they did for me. I mean, it's twice as big as the Air America ad. Air America is a liberal, a national liberal talk network. And I'm not even sure how this happened. I said to him, you know, I don't really need an ad. I'm not a national show, even though a lot of you listen nationally, a lot of you listen internationally. And welcome to you, and I'm glad you're here. But in a sense, I don't, I'm not trying to say I don't want you here. But in terms of the purposes of this show, to provide public affairs broadcasting for WRIF, if there was 10 people listening to the show, they would still air it, because WRIF, mostly a rock station, has to have public affairs broadcasting. I'm the public affairs director. So this is all kind of just gratuitous, wonderfully gratuitous, because now we've linked in with people all across the planet via the internet. So there's lots more of you. And you can get this issue in the Detroit area, the radio waves issue of The Nation, the May 23rd edition. Oh, let me see. Go to the Independents first. Go to like Paperbacks Unlimited in Ferndale, Bookbeat in Oak Park, New Horizons in Roseville, Marwell's on the Wayne State University campus in downtown Detroit. And if this is going, if you've never been to any of these bookstores, they're all wonderful bookstores, and they all are, what a concept, right? Independent. And they deserve your support. If you go to my website, you can also, if you go to books, there's a book down the left side. Click on that, and that'll give you a list and the address of all of them. They also carry the 40th anniversary issue of the Fifth Estate newspaper. And again, we need a little full disclosure here. I write for that as well. So, hey, self-serving? I'm not selling stuff. You know, half these talks, what, half? 90% of these talk show hosts, particularly the right-wingers, are peddling merchandise. I'm not. All right. Peter Werbes is my name. Night Call is the show, broadcasting from Detroit in Michigan in the United States of America, in case you're listening somewhere other than this country. 313-298-WRIF is our phone number. If you'd like to email me from around here or anywhere in the world, calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Calltalkyes@yahoo.com. The website, peterwerbe.com. You can get in a chat room. Go to tomhartman.com. Register for Tom's chat room, and then you can talk to people that are listening to this show as well. There's a rebroadcast every Monday, courtesy of radiopower.org, at 9 a.m. and 6 p.m. So if you miss any of this, or you want to tell your friends to listen to it, you can go to radiopower.org. Some people are listening through radiopower.org. Archived at whiterosesociety.org. Okay, enough information. In fact, that was a little information heavy, wasn't it? Well, after riots across the world because of the Newsweek report that the U.S. interrogators had desecrated the Quran at Guantanamo, the magazine apologized, saying that it had made a mistake in its May 9th edition, and the fact that they were mistaken in reporting that U.S. interrogators had flushed the Quran down the toilet. Whew. And they apologize to the victims of deadly Muslim protests sparked by the article. Sorry about that, right? Editor Mark Whitaker said, We regret. Ooh, that's hard to say. That's like bugs money. We regret that we got any part of our story wrong, and extend our sympathies to victims of the violence of the U.S. soldiers caught in the midst. Whitaker said the magazine inaccurately reported that U.S. military investigators had confirmed that personnel at the detention facility in Cuba had flushed the Quran down the toilet. The Pentagon told the magazine the report was wrong, saying it had investigated earlier allegations of Quran desecration from detainees and found them, quote, not credible. Well, we shall see. I think we haven't heard the last of this story, that's for sure. Anti-U.S. riot turns deadly in Afghanistan. Now, you know, when a spark sets off something like this has, there's a lot more to it. I mean, it's easy for us to see these people as just crazy mobs. I mean, certainly if they flush any book of mine down a toilet, I wouldn't get very upset. As we know, religious fervor on the part of any organized religion frequently turns out to be deadly. All right? That's one of the dangers of organized religion. And when you have thousands of demonstrators shouting death to America in Afghanistan and then in other Muslim countries around the world and in Iraq, increasingly a population becoming more and more hostile to American occupiers, and we see the figures, $300 billion for Bush's war, Aren't there, well, I guess, yeah, I guess increasing numbers, more than 50% now, wonder, what in the hell are we doing? Now, Bush was over in the Republic of Georgia and telling tens of thousands, remember this was earlier in the week, of these people from in the Georgian capital, that he supported democracy and that the sovereignty of Georgia, quote, must be respected by all nations. So certainly a slightly veiled criticism of Vladimir Putin, president of Russia. Now, one wonders, how in the world does George W. Bush get off lecturing? For one, I mean, we take this for granted, that this guy goes around the country lecturing other countries about democracy. In the meantime, I mean, Putin puts pressure on some of these countries on the periphery of Russia because they're concerned about their security and invasion. You know, Europe invaded them, what, three times in the last 150, 60 years. Napoleon, Germans twice. So they're real concerned about what happens on their border and what the border states, who the border states are aligned with. But Bush, he invades countries halfway around the world and close to the Soviet, or what is it now, Russia, right? So this is, that's pretty crazy. Now, it turns out, I mean, I can't believe that there's still a few of you that hold any belief that George W. Bush acted in an honest manner in the run-up to the invasion of Iraq, that they did not know from the beginning, Bush Co., Bush and Company, Bush Incorporated, acting for the oil companies, acting for his own domestic political fortunes, that they didn't realize that there were absolutely no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, that there was no connection to September 11th, and that Saddam Hussein did not represent any threat to countries in the region. Well, now it comes out that, in fact, that's absolutely the case. And, of course, everybody in Britain knows this, but we, in the dark, because our media is focused on Michael Jackson and runaway brides and the rest. Now, in Yahoo News, it says a new memo gate. Knight Ritter covers leaked British document that disputes Bush's claim on Iraq. I mean, why there's not millions of people in the street demanding that Bush be thrown out of office is just says something for the passivity of all of us, even though the majority of us now think the invasion of Iraq was not worth it. For much of the week, much of the U.S. press paid little attention to the highly classified British memo leaked to a British newspaper, which seems to reveal that President Bush decided by summer 2002 to overthrow Iraqi President Saddam Hussein and was determined to ensure that U.S. intelligence data supported his policy. In other words, they're rigging it, right? The memo was first disclosed by the Sunday Times of London. Representative John Conyers of Detroit, the top Democrat on the House Judiciary Committee, has gained 88 signatures on a letter among fellow Democrats asking the White House for an explanation of the memo. Now, let me see if I can get you what it says here. The Downing Street memo, as it's now being called, reveals that George Bush decided to overthrow Iraqi president in summer 2002, determined to ensure that the U.S. intelligence data supported his policy and fixed the intelligence and facts relevant to weapons of mass destruction. I mean, are there still some of you listening that can't get this through your heads? Are you so in love with power and authority that you can't figure it out that this guy has made a fool of you? You're still running around with a Bush sticker on your SUV or your truck or your car? I mean, you really look like an idiot. I mean, I'm sorry to say. But with all these revelations of corruption and duplicity and out-and-out lies, the crumbling of the economy, these wars that are just taking more and more lives, the creation of increasing hostility to us, what will it take? How dumb are you? Oh, I know. It's not polite. I should be nicer. I should, right? The contents of the memo are shocking. And this is from DowningStreetMemo.com. Downing Street is where the British Prime Minister has his joint. You can go to my website and link onto it, PeterWerby.com. The contents of the memo are shocking. The minutes detail how our government did not believe Iraq was a greater threat than other nations, how intelligence was manipulated to sell the case for war to the American public, and how all the talk of war as a last resort were mere hollow pretense. In other words, lies, right? John Conyers from Michigan is peeved. He can't understand why an explosive story published earlier this month in England hasn't received more attention here. Let's see if there's anything new in here. No. All right. So, yeah, I wonder. A lot of people wonder. Here, every week, I say, I'm going to bring up positive solutions. People frequently email me, and they say, Pete, all you do is complain. All you do is criticize. All you do is bash Bush. All you do is rag on the cons, right? The conservatives. What's your solution? And every week I think, well, I'm going to just run all the laundry list. But, you know, as long as we have in power these people that are going to erode everything from democracy to the economy to the environment to job security and keep putting continuing on these wars, there's no hope for a positive solution. For one thing, we don't have the money. We absolutely don't have the money. You know, they were talking about delaying the space shuttle, right? Until at least July. They want to get the space shuttle up again. Well, where are we, you know, it's like spending somebody who's going in debt suddenly deciding to take a trip to Europe or something like that. We don't have the money for this stuff. I mean, I've always, we've talked about the space shuttle before. They've had about 50 flights and 2 fatal accidents. I don't know, would you go up in a plane if you knew there was a 1 in 25 chance of failure? But, I keep thinking, what is going on here? I mean, are these guys just totally insane? I mean, they're pretty psycho. Bushco, people running this place. But it's clear when you have the far right wing beginning to attack the memory of Franklin Delano Roosevelt that they are that their grand strategy is to roll back everything that we take for granted in modern society. They're going to return us to the 19th century. So when they destroy all the social networks and all the social safety nets, when they destroy the unions, it's going to be the 19th century. So get ready for your kids to work. Get ready for the 12-hour day to return. Now, Bush, always a piece of work. You heard what happened the other day, right? On the day after more than 30,000 people, including the vice president, the first lady, and a former first lady, were evacuated from their offices or homes in Washington, D.C., the president was biking in Maryland and was not notified until the threat had passed. Remember, this was the small plane that entered the space, the prohibited space, and they went on full terror alert. The government did. Sent in all sorts of planes, and it turned out it was just some small plane that guys kind of got lost or something like that. And this is from Editor and Publisher. I guess the website is just editorandpublisher.com. It must be, yeah, editorandpublisher.com. For those who might have missed it on TV, that is nearly everyone, here are some choice excerpts. Oh, this, I'm not going to read you. This is from the press conference with Scott McClellan. But anyways, it says that McClellan continually refers to protocols, and reporters essentially ask, wouldn't most men like to know when their home is evacuated and their wife is hustled to a secure bunker? They also wonder about the small matter of the president being commander-in-chief and the Capitol potentially being under attack. So Bush is bicycling. What does this sound like? Any memories? Any memories when the last time Deer in the Headlights was at a crisis point and couldn't figure out what to do? Maybe they figured he performed so badly on September 11, 2001, and sat there in that classroom reading My Pet Goat and not having the ability to function as a commander-in-chief, they probably figured, why even bother? Let him bike. Let him bike. He'll just bicycle. That's all he will do. Let's see if there's anything else. Well, all right, I've got tons of stuff, but I'd like to hear from you. My name's Peter Werbe. Call talkyes at yahoo.com for email, 313-298-WRIF. I'm curious if you've seen the ad for this program in the nation. Either give a shout on the phone or give me an email. I'm curious whether that's what kind of impact it is. I was thinking, as I said earlier, for the purpose of this show, I don't really need advertising, but I thought, Well, this is going to be nice. Maybe some old pals of mine that are scattered all over the country and all over the world will see this and haven't even thought of me for 10 or 20 years and will go to my website and email me. So hopefully I'll get lots of old friends getting a hold of me. I just wanted to read this to you, though. This is a letter from Mark in Ferndale. By the way, if you're listening across the country or overseas, and I say Ferndale or Southgate or something like that, if I don't say the state, it's Michigan, this is the broadcast area, and it's right outside of Detroit. This is what Mark writes from Ferndale. He writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. I'm a 42-year-old man, a moderate liberal, if there is such a thing. I want to do something about the way this country is headed. I have radical bumper stickers on his car. Save our country, throw Bush out. But that ain't doing it for me or anyone else, he says. I don't feel like I can write my congressman like they used to say to complain. It's like in the invasion of the body snatchers. Just overnight, it seems like the right wing has become so strong and taken over. And what the hell do they have to be so pissed about? They run the show now, right or wrong, legal or not. I'm so angry. I feel paralyzed, helpless. Any ideas? Any ideas? Now, I wrote him back. And I don't think I gave him very good suggestions. I said, go to my website, go to my calendar, and see some of the events that are going on. Or check out, you can just go to some of the area restaurants in Ferndale where I often go and see leaflets up for things. There's demonstrations and there's musical events and, conferences and teach-ins and what have you. Most of them aren't very well attended. So, and even though the majority of people do not think Bush is doing a good job. Don't give him good ratings as a president. The majority of people think the invasion of Iraq was a mistake. But the right wing, this minority, kind of the same percentage of the German population that voted Hitler in. Yeah, you don't like that? Too bad. They have control of the major institutions of this society. And they're having their way. And the formal opposition just ain't up to the task. Liberals, as they're organized, aren't doing it. The institutions of liberals, the Democratic Party, the trade unions, I don't know what else, aren't of a character that they're able to withstand these really aggressive people with this very, very specific agenda to completely unravel the gains that ordinary people have made over the last 100 years. I mean, they're bound and determined to ship us back to the 19th century. So one of the things that has to happen is that we have to reorganize ourselves into, first, adequate defensive organizations of resistance, whole communities of resistance that are going to protect our standard of living from these people, our rights as citizens to stop this autocratic theocracy that these folks have in mind, stop the destruction of our organizations that have brought us at least a somewhat decent standard of living, and on and on. Then, or maybe at the same time, we have to develop a vision of how we want this country to be. Because if you think about the right wing and their criticisms of the left, even of liberals, let alone the left, essentially what they're saying is everything is okay just the way it is. They refute even the weakest liberal objections to this drive towards full totalitarian right-wing revolution. Right? So they think everything is swell. Everything is swell in this country. Everything is swell in the world. Right? That's essentially what they want to conserve. Conservatives have always throughout history wanted to conserve the worst of society as it's currently constituted. When they're challenged, when there's a great challenge to things as they are, they're always on the side of the worst reactionaries. That is, if it's 1776, they're on the side of the British. If it's 1861, they're on the side of the slavers. If it's 1876 through 1954, they're on the side of the racists. And on and on and on. And if it's in Germany, they're on the side of Hitler. If they're in Spain, they're on the side of Franco. These are the conservatives. There is nothing unique about conservatives that you're going to find any different anywhere in this world. They're every point, they're on the side of wealth and power and authority over the interests of the common people, the middle class and the working class, and certainly the poor who they spit upon. It's that simple. I mean, they've got some, you know, phony arguments about freedom and stuff like that. But eventually, all you got to do is look at who are they carrying water for. And usually, the conservatives, the ideological conservatives that aren't real wealthy, I mean, they need shock troops. I mean, we're talking about, you know, rulers that are 1% or 5% of the population, so they can't win anything there. So they have to convince people to support them, even though what they're supporting is against their own self-interest, the shock troops. So it's a nice little trick. So what you need is a bunch of psychos who love power and authority, no matter how dictatorial or authoritarian, or even the power that will diminish themselves as human beings. That's how twisted they are. That's why I call them twistoids. Right. Should I tell you what I really think? Nah, I better not. All right, Peter Werbe here with you, 313-298-WRIF, speaking of Southgate, let's go to Eric in Southgate. Eric, hi, it's Peter Werbe, you're on the air.
Hello?
Hello, Eric, go ahead, you're on the air.
Hey, man, I've been listening to you for 22 years.
Really?
Yeah, since I was 11, 1982, and you finally got your computer that works.
Yeah.
Anyways, I got three disorderly persons resisting arrest and a felonious assault of an officer. About in the same week, I was in rehab. $60,000 the government spent in rehab. That's not including.
Wait, Eric, you're just off on some free association. What's this all about? Tell me what this is all about before you tell me the details.
Okay, well, since 9/11, all the guys been working out, doing steroids or whatever. Who knows? And you remember the CBS song, "Ohio, Four Dead in Ohio."
Yeah, about the Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young song about Kent State. Yeah.
Okay, well, it seems like these, and my buddy just hung himself, and he served in the Persian Gulf, and all my friends went in the Persian Gulf, and I collected disability.
Well, you know what, Eric? It sounds like there's a whole raft of problems here, none of which I think are that I can solve, and I don't know that airing them publicly is going to solve them either. So let's call it a day here, all right? I appreciate your call, though, and I hope you good luck on all of it. All right, Jay Hudson is our producer here, 313-298-WRIF. I don't see who to take next, so I will just go to the person who's been listening and waiting the longest. It's Jeff in Brownstown. Hey, Jeff, it's Peter Werbe. You're on the air. Hi.
Hey, what's up?
Hey, turn your radio off, dude.
All right,
I'm
phone.
Where's the moon?
The moon?
Yeah,
you think it's a full moon?
Yeah.
I didn't pull my shorts down yet.
Okay. What's up? Tell me quick.
I don't have to make it quick, do I? Wait a minute. Like that proud to be American stuff, you know, there's too much pride, you know, and ownership.
Yeah.
There's too many people that are thought to be hypocrites because we say one thing, but we basically do another and stuff like that. That's the way, you know, the leadership is basically seen, you know, like, you know, from, you know, like, but I wouldn't necessarily blame it on Republicans or Democrats. Well, I think it's more of an educational thing that people aren't well informed, you know.
Well, that has to do more with the media. Of course, the educational system is going down the drain as well. Jeff, thanks. Whoa. All right. Let's try it again. Here is, this must be Orion and Taylor. Orion, you're on the air. Hi.
Doing, Peter? How about yourself?
Doing great.
Hey, I was going to say, I was listening to you earlier about, you're talking about Bush in 2002.
Yeah?
Well, I was remembering back in 2000, he was talking about going to war then. He was a warmonger then.
Mm-hmm. I don't think he was talking about... See, these guys lied all along. I mean, Bush tried to present himself as a moderate. In fact, he did. And a lot of people swallowed it. Not the majority of people. I remember the majority of people voted against him in 2000. But he wasn't talking any war talk back then.
Well, from what I remember, he was sitting there saying something about being a war president. And Me, myself, I'm a Desert Storm veteran.
Yeah.
That's why I remember that.
Okay.
And, of course, you know, knowing he's George, he's the first George's son.
Right.
That's the first thing I thought of. I'm like, oh, man, what's he going to do, going to Iraq? When we should have had it done in the first place in 91.
Well, George the First nixed that.
NATO nixed that, really.
No, it was just George himself. They wanted Saddam Hussein to continue in power, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
Wasn't that he didn't finish the job. The job wasn't what he told the American people.
Yeah.
I mean, they were fearful following Gulf War One, Desert Storm, that Iraq would fall apart. I mean, that its constituent ethnic groups would just break apart. That the Kurds would declare an independent nation. The Shiites might join with Iran, and there was this. And that's why Saddam Hussein was left in power, and that's why the United States allowed Saddam Hussein's Republican Guard, which they allowed to remain intact, and just slaughtered thousands and thousands and thousands of hapless draftees. As they were marching out of Kuwait City, they allowed the Republican Guard to attack the Kurds and to attack the Shiites. And so when you start talking about these tens of thousands of dead from that war, that's right at the hands of George Bush the First. All right, thanks a lot. Appreciate your call. Let's take another before we do any business here, which we'll have to go to in a minute. It's Jason from Wayne. Jason, hi, it's Peter Werby.
Hey, what's up? I just got one thing to say. I don't know if he meets the prerequisites, but I'm worried a couple years down the road when another election comes by that we're going to hit some twilight zone and Jeb Bush is going to end up in office.
Well, family dynasty, eh?
Yeah, exactly, and it wouldn't be a good one either.
What about the girls? If they can stay sober.
Yeah, but, you know, look, he's already screwing up his state. You know, that's why I was thinking about moving there, and I decided not to because one Bush is enough, you know.
All right. Thank you. Appreciate your call. We'll be right back.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Hit the great outdoors with the OSI Pro Series WRIF Fishing Championships. On May 28th, the series resumes with the Michigan Catfish Championship at Lake Erie Metro Park. Thousands in cash and prizes up for grabs, along with the title of 2005 champion. For more information or to sign up today, log on at WRIF.com.
Detroit's Rock Station 101 WRIF and WRIF.com bring you the hottest deals in the Motor City. At WRIF.com, you are only one click away from dining at some of your favorite restaurants for only half price. Dine online and eat for less. Save a ton of money with some of Metro Detroit's best restaurants, like Walker's Speakeasy, the West Side's hottest destination for great food, drinks, and daily entertainment. Located on Beach Daily in Dearborn Heights. Log on to www.wrif.com. You can purchase full price gift certificates to area restaurants for only half price, but quantities are limited, so you better act fast. For more details, log on to WRIF.com and be sure to check out even more special offers and savings. Like Buddy's Pizza, come into any of Buddy's 9 locations today. Enjoy one of the nation's best pizza places as recognized by the Food Network. Buddy's, Detroit's number one pizza since 1946. Log on today and save at WRIF.com. Time is running out. Time is running out on the best deal ever, on your opportunity to make an investment that can help you make more money and that will change your life forever. Time is running out on your chance to register for Oakland Community College's spring 2005 semester. Final walk-in registration for spring classes is May 5th and 6th. Register on the web or visit any of OCC's 5 convenient campuses to sign up for your choice of thousands of day, night, and weekend classes in literally hundreds of subjects like business, psychology, computer information systems, physics, English, pre-engineering, robotics, and more. If you want to take a giant step to a better life, Oakland Community College is your educational answer. Call or visit your local OCC campus now. They're in Auburn Hills, Waterford, Farmington Hills, Royal Oak, and Southfield. Remember, final walk-in registration is May 5th and 6th. Oakland Community College. Get anywhere from here.
Classes begin May 9th.
Take to the ice with 101 WRIF and Labatt Blues 21 and over Summer Hockey Challenge. Games run in June at rinks across Detroit with a 3-game guarantee. All skill levels are welcome. More info available at WRIF.com or call Suburban Training Center at 248-888-1400. Get hockey with Labatt Blue and 101 WRIF.
Rip, 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 rip.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
All right, thanks a lot. Thank you. Welcome back. Give us a call, 313-298-WRIF. Email at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. As I've always said, usually talk show hosts are supposed to pose questions, right? I'm not doing a good job of it. Maybe, how about this for a question, about the fact that President Deer in the Headlights was not notified that 30,000 people, including the Vice President, the First Lady, and a former First Lady, were evacuated from their offices and homes in Washington this last week. And I wonder who made this call and just let Bush continue biking in Maryland. The reporters were asking, wouldn't most men like to know when their home is evacuated and their wife is hustled to a secure bunker? And what about the fact that Bush is the commander-in-chief and the Capitol might have been under attack? Or, I asked rhetorically, maybe they thought, given his performance on September 11th, that's why I call him Deer in the Headlights. Remember that footage you've seen? A lot of you have seen it in Fahrenheit 9/11. That he's kind of useless anyway, right? That he's, you get back to that thing where he's just the sock puppet and other people are making the calls. All right. Let's go back to your calls. Let's do that. I've got about 110 other things as usual, but I want to hear what you have to say. Here's Sean in Plymouth. Sean, hi. It's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter. How are you?
Hi. Good. Good.
Hey, quick couple things for you.
Sure.
First off, you know, it's easy to criticize when you say, you know, Deer in Headlights. Yeah, I understand, you know, Bush isn't the best public speaker ever. That's a given. But, you know, given September 11th, who knows what anybody would do.
So, well, I don't think anybody could have performed worse, do you?
I don't know.
Maybe.
You
know,
this is the biggest tragedy since World War II.
Yeah. Now, who's responsible for it? Who was the commander-in-chief and responsible for the security of the nation on September 11, 2001? Hello?
But this was well in the planning, well before Bush ever came into office.
All right. But at some point, you know, and old Harry Truman said the buck stops here. You got to remember, too, is that the security advisor for it all kept urging Bush and Ashcroft and Condoleezza Rice to call meetings that would specifically concern themselves with attacks on the United States by Osama bin Laden. And they uniformly refused to even call a meeting. I think it was, they finally called one the week of September 11th, before, maybe like on Monday or the week before or something like that. They received memos saying Osama bin Laden plans attacks in the United States, and Bush went to Crawford. I've said this 1,000 times, if Al Gore would have been the president on September 11th, 2001, the Republicans would have moved to impeach him for malfeasance in office and misfeasance in office.
I don't know. I mean, we had a chance to get Osama bin Laden when Mr. Clinton was in office, and Mr. Clinton was on the golf course, and he couldn't be reached, so... You know.
I don't know if that's true, but, and you know, I don't want to defend Clinton in any event, but what are you saying? I mean, that's the argument that says Bush is as bad as Clinton. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. You know, it's not a Republican thing. It's not a Democratic thing. It's politics in general.
Well, I tend to agree with that, particularly with the Republican. Well, normally I would have said with the Republican and the Democratic Party, but there's getting to be vast differences between the two, which there never were before. And most of the Clinton years, I spent my time criticizing them very, very strongly. I mean, I didn't accept the fact that that there was an attempt to derail the whole presidency by this phony impeachment stuff. But if Al Gore would have rightfully taken his place as the elected president of the United States in 2000, I would have been on his case big time. And I'll tell you, if he would have dropped the ball, if President Al Gore would have dropped the ball as badly as Bush and company, the whole Bush crowd did on September 11th, and people said, we should impeach Al Gore, I don't think you would have heard me saying, oh, well, give him another chance, or it could have happened to anybody, or whatever. Because I'll tell you, there's a lot of reasons, a lot of excuses, a lot of explanation, but the long and the short of it is thousands of people are dead because of the inability of the Bush administration to comprehend the threat.
Yeah, I agree with you on that, but you know, we don't know as a general public because of what is restricted knowledge, but we don't know what has been withheld as far as, you know, it was, you know, during the Clinton administration, was it during the Bush senior administration, was it during the Ronald Reagan administration, as far as the inadequacies of the CIA and the, you know, our intelligence group.
Well, let's make this assumption, which I don't think this is completely true, but for just for the sake of argument, Clinton totally 100% screwed it up. Didn't do anything right, didn't do anything good. So here comes January 20th, 2001. There's a new president, and his task is to defend the country. So what does he do? Absolutely nothing. So Clinton may have been awful, George Bush the first may have, Ronald Reagan, who knows, going all the way back to when they first started backing the Mujahideen in Afghanistan that created these monsters that eventually turned on us and attacked us. But ultimately, Bush was responsible for the security of the United States, and it was a catastrophic failure of intelligence. And I don't think it can be laid anywhere other than at Bush's doorstep.
Well, you know, that's, I mean, being in the automotive industry, that's like saying, you know, the downfall of the big three is the new CEOs and CFOs' fault as well.
I mean, I know there's a lot of grander, that's not a bad point. I mean, there's grander social forces at work, often larger than the people involved can intuit. But,
right.
You know, somebody's got to take the blame. I mean, might there be new CEOs for our troubled big three, you know, that made this town, the Motor City? There sure might be. I bet you there's tons of stockholders that are thinking, hey, if our stock is dropping precipitously, I always use that word. Someone says, what the hell does that mean? I don't know, quickly or something. If it's going down the tubes, maybe we need some new leadership.
Exactly.
All right. We agree. Thank you. In fact, let me see. What is something I had here? This is Paul Krugman. And writing in the New York Times, he says, last week, Standard & Poor's, a bond rating agency, downgraded both Ford and General Motors bonds to junk status. Can you imagine this? That is, it sees a significant risk that the companies won't be able to pay their debts. Don't cry for the bondholders, says Paul Krugman, but cry for the workers. Standard & Poor's downgraded GM and Ford sooner rather than later because it believes that the public is losing interest in SUVs. Because you always know, you know, they got little teeny cars, and they come big cars, and, you know, or they have big cars and little teeny cars, and they went to big cars. Well, now, you know, Bush's buddies are pushing the price of oil up so high, everybody's beginning to think, man, did I make the right choice? I'll tell you, I have a Ford, you know, like a Taurus, a Ford, and I'm thinking, you know, I should have bought a Honda, which is exactly, I mean, that's what I'm thinking. I bought the car made right, actually I think it was made in New Jersey, but that's what you start thinking, because this thing is sucking gas, and I'm thinking, man, I could get like a third more. So anyways, so people are beginning to leave these gas guzzlers. He said the companies were vulnerable because they still pay decent wages and offer good benefits in an age when taking care of employees has gone out of style. And this is what has to concern all of us as working people, middle class and working class. The downgrade was a reminder of how far we have come, Paul Krugman says, from the days when hardworking Americans could count on a reasonable degree of economic security. Our parents and what have you, they work hard. You get a nice little suburban place, and the auto companies and the union pensions would take care of you. And you get a little cabin up in Houghton Lake. You know the drill if you're from this area. In 1968, when General Motors was widely emulated, was a widely emulated icon of American business. In other words, that's what people looked for as a model. Many of its workers were lifetime employees. On average, they earned about $29,000 a year in today's dollars, a solidly middle-class income at the time. They also had generous health and retirement benefits. Since then, America has grown much richer. People say, Wherever you're always talking about the redistribution of income, you're a commie. These are the people that have talked about a redistribution of income. As we've created more and more wealth for this country, rather than having it be shared with the people that produced it, that work hard in offices and factories, it's all been gobbled up by the top 10%, particularly the top 5 and 1%. So this is a redistribution of income, but it's class war practiced by the people on top. That's how it goes. But let's see. Today, Walmart is America's largest corporation. Like General Motors in its prime, it has become a widely emulated business icon. In other words, a model. But he says that's where the resemblance ends. The average full-time Walmart employee is paid only about $17,000 a year. The company's health care plan covers fewer than half of its workers. And these are, the combined Walton fortune is makes them the wealthiest family in America and probably then in the world as well. And these selfish, get the kids away from the radio, I'm going to say a bad word. These selfish son of a bitches are, have our friends and neighbors working in these stores when for these kind of wages and lack of health benefits when they could afford to pay them handsomely because they're making so much money. And instead, like Walton's daughter is, she's out. They're gonna have an art museum. And what are they from? Benetton? Is that no? That's the name of that. That's the name of that company. But whatever they're from in Arkansas, they're buying tens of millions of dollars of art. So they're going to have this art museum in Arkansas, as opposed to paying decently people that are working hard, trying to be good family members and community members, or even just support themselves. It says, let's see. He says, true. This is Paul Krugman in the New York Times. Not everyone is paid badly. In 1968, the head of General Motors received about $4 million in today's dollars, and that was considered extravagant. Last year, Scott Lee Jr., Walmart's chief executive, was paid $17.5 million. That is, every 2 weeks, Mr. Lee was paid about as much as his average employee will earn in a lifetime. Not many of them will actually spend a lifetime at Walmart. 40% of the people leave every year. Well, who wouldn't? All right. Let me just go one more thing. This has to do with the Pentagon talking about this massive overhaul of bases, as the headline says. But what they're doing, they're going to close 33 major facilities in 22 states, reconfigure hundreds of others to achieve savings and promote cooperation among the armed forces. Well, naturally, all of the towns and cities where this is occurring are going crazy because they're depending on the military budget in order to provide jobs. I think right now they're going to lose 26,000 jobs. Imagine, I don't think all of you have to imagine. You know what it means when you lose a job. What it means to a community when hundreds and maybe even 1,000 or more lose a job in a particular city and they have families and then people don't spend as much in that local community. Again, wealthiest country in the world, but this, taxes are a transfer of wealth. We earn whatever, 100%, and then X percentage of it is transferred to the government. Now, in countries that care about its citizens, and where, or maybe you could just put it where the citizens demand that the government care about the citizens, this is funneled back. This is funneled back in a manner that makes life in general better for everyone. It creates health, universal health care. It creates good schools. It has all the infrastructure that is needed to have a life that we would think that that countries like ours could provide to the citizenry. Instead, it turns out to be a system of looting, much like the conservatives are aspiring to the 19th century version of it. So our taxes then are funneled through the government and then given to supporters of Bush. So tax breaks are given to huge drug corporations. Bush's pals destroy countries, and then Bush's pals rebuild them. We pay for this all. So this is a transfer of wealth. This is a redistribution of wealth. And in the meantime, our wages get driven down more and more and more. And some of you may be thinking, hey, it's not happening to me. Things are fine with me. I live in a fancy house. I go to Birmingham. I go to Grosse Pointe. You know, everything's kind of cool. I don't have to worry. Well, things are fraying more and more around the edges. I don't have, I'm actually pretty at a good spot right now. And every once in a while, I mean, I was at a with a bunch of people, and I started to say things were going pretty well for me, and I realized that people I was with had lost their jobs, that they had relatives that had once worked in the computer industry and now were working as security guards, on and on like that. And this is just the beginning. I mean, a third of us will wind up to be well-waged and consumers, because that's going to be the model that occurs. So it'll be like, I always use the country of Guatemala. So we'll, you know, I don't even know. I mean, I'm hoping, because I'm thinking, you know, eventually I have pensions and I have Social Security and, you know, I have what have you. I mean, you know, I have, my union would provide a pension. This company would provide a pension. I'd have Social Security. Will I? They didn't used to. And that's where they're heading. And Bush wants to get rid of Social Security, doesn't want to reform it. And United Airlines has just won the right to default on its employee pension plans. So is any of this going to be here? For even about, even those of us who are, quote, doing okay right now. And I'll tell you, one of the reasons I'm doing okay is I don't have kids. My wife and I never had any children. So I don't have to pay for raising them, and I don't have to pay for sending them to college and what have you. And I don't think I'd be doing okay if I had two or three kids. All right, your thoughts, please. Peter Werbe here with you. 313-298-WRIF, waiting patiently. Chuck from Waterford. Chuck, hey, it's Peter Werbe. You're on the air.
I'm on the air?
You are on the air right now, sir.
Oh, wow, great. Thanks for having me on. I was calling, something you said a couple weeks ago, sparked my interest. You said that it seemed like most Americans weren't paying very much attention.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's entirely true. Most of them could probably go on at length about the movie they watched last weekend or their favorite TV or show or something, and they don't know beans about real history.
Yeah, we're not the most informed population in the world, that's for sure.
Definitely. And I know personally I've always loved history, and I've been particularly interested in military history. So just out of curiosity, I got a quick little quiz for you here.
Sure.
Let's see if you can tell me what the common thread is in these four things.
Okay, go ahead.
Weapons of mass destruction.
Okay.
The Gulf of Tonkin incident.
Yeah.
The sinking of the Lusitania.
And the sinking of the Maine.
Yeah, remember the Maine? The hell with Spain.
All based on lies. All brought us into wars.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very important. I mean, there's an oft-quoted phrase from, I don't know, who was he? Santayana or somebody like that. It said, those who do not learn from history are condemned to relive it, and we just keep reliving it and reliving it.
Right. It seems like Bush just pulled some tried and proven old tricks to, you know, sway public opinion.
Yeah.
And got to wage his little war the way he wanted.
Absolutely. And it was kind of split. How was the party split between Republicans and Democrats? Test your history on that one.
In which situation?
Well, all four.
All four? Republicans. In World War One, the Democrats had taken power.
Right.
In Spain, the Republicans had just taken power.
Right.
And then the Democrats won it back, but World War One happened. And then with Vietnam, it was the Republicans.
No, Democrats. It was 1964 was when there was the false claim that the United States... ships had been attacked in the Bay of Tonkin, Lyndon Baines Johnson sent the troops. So it's 2-2.
Right, but it was Eisenhower that sent the initial military advisors.
Yeah, right. I mean, who knows? I mean, there's some talk that Kennedy was assassinated because he was intending to pull the troops out. I mean, that's even a big historical debate.
Well, it's kind of interesting, even if you look back into World War II. Ho Chi Minh was... trained by the American, the SAS, the Military Secret Service.
The OAS,
and they were training him to fight the Japanese.
Sure.
But then when the war ended, instead of giving him his country, we gave it back to the French because, you know, They had been ravaged by World War II. They needed their colonies back to rebuild. So
that was the argument, at least. Yeah, I mean, so if you look at a lot of the problems that have plagued this world for the last 100 years, they are about the attempt of Western nations, from Britain and the United States and France and Germany, to dominate through colonialism and imperialism other parts of the world.
Right. Right, like Noam Chomsky says, it's all about power and privilege and controlling it.
It is. Thank you, sir. I appreciate your call.
Okay, thanks for having me on.
All right, and yeah, got to learn from history, or it all seems like it's reinvented each time. So you can, that's why people can watch Foxhole News and think, oh yeah, that makes plenty of sense. Well, if it's a closed system, yeah. I mean, it's like you know, people that that learned history in Nazi Germany or, you know, Soviet Union or something like that. It's such a closed system that internally it all makes sense, even though it's you know, it's just nothing but lies. I mean, that's what you get if you restrict yourself to something like Foxhole News. All right, hang on. We'll come right back. I'll tell you about the guests we're going to have a little later. So keep calling. 313-298-WRIF.
This is WRIF.com.
Bill Bonds, get a pencil. Couple of questions. How's the world looking to you? How do you see things? A little fuzzy, a lot of squinting going on. Baby blues need a little springtime tune-up. Well, meet the Bonds Family Eye Doctor. Phone 877, then the letters U-S-E-E-M-O-R-E. 877-U-C-MORE. Dr. Combati is the man. The Lake Laser Eye Center, the most modern, high-tech, state-of-the-art optical procedure equipment ever made. Procedure virtually painless. Faster than you can blink an eye. You're in, then you're out. No more fuzzy, hard-to-read street or freeway signs. 877-U-C-MORE. How good is Dr. Combati? Well, my wife's baby blues are so good now that she can see through me. 877-UC-MORE. Dr. Combati is the doctor. And when it's done, you're going to tell everybody you see, man, why didn't I do it years ago? Oh, by the way, you can jump on the net, ucmore.com. Bill Bonds. I'll see you.
Every day, employers search for people skilled in today's technology. Are you ready for a change to a new career? Make a difference for yourself by calling the ITT Technical Institutes at 1-800-396-6622. Find out how an ITT tech can help you prepare for a career in electronics, information technology, or drafting and design. Nationwide, thousands have launched technical careers after graduating from an ITT tech. Classes meet just a few times a week to help you balance school and your job. Financial aid is available for those who qualify, and career assistance is available once you graduate. Now is your chance to make a difference for yourself, to start a new path to a career involving technology. Find out what an ITT Tech education can offer you. Call 1-800-396-6622 for an ITT Tech brochure. Classes are forming now, so call ITT Tech at 1-800-396-6622. That's 1-800-396-6622.
Hit the great outdoors with the OSI Pro Series WRIF Fishing Championships. On May 28th, the series resumes with the Michigan Catfish Championship at Lake Erie Metro Park. Thousands in cash and prizes up for grabs, along with the title of 2005 champion. For more information or to sign up today, log on at WRIF.com.
Riff rocks the road. Every week, check out WRIF.com for information on upcoming Riff events. Sponsored by Wireless Toys, announcing no more activation fees. Get reimbursed for the activation fee on any new service, any new provider.
Riff rocks.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much. Welcome back to the second hour of our program. And if you're just joining us, particularly those of you listening on the internet, welcome. And those of you listening in the Detroit area, say, wait a minute, what are we? Chopped liver? Hey, we are the core of WRIF's audience. I know that. And I love you all, even those of you who write me these critical, that's being mild, emails at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. We've been joined by a host of new listeners as a result of an ad that appeared for this program in The Nation magazine, the May 23rd edition. You go to thenation.com, although they already have their May 30th edition online. You can go to any number of independent bookstores and pick up The Nation, and they have a special issue on radio, Radio Waves, it's called, and mostly about talk and news radio. I'm not talking about music in this case. And so I did say that I had an ad in there, so that they placed for me very nicely. And I mean, they said, do you want to design it? And I said, no, you do it. And I was kind of nervous about what it would look like, but it's absolutely incredible. So, but go to an independent bookstore and check it out. Also, the Kipfers are listening in Oregon. They say, how about a shout-out? We've been WRF fans for a good number of years, so welcome. For some reason or other, excuse me, I've been getting about 50 emails a not here, I wish, 50 emails a day in German. I don't know what in the hell is going on. Anybody got an idea about that? My email address is calltalkyes@yahoo.com. And I wish I could do better German, even though my last name, Verba, maybe that's why I got it. It means advertising. And radio advertising, Verba Funken. I didn't say what you think I said. Funken, right? Like F-U-N-K-E-N? Yeah. Anyway, if I can... I've never... hardly said a word of German other than Achtung or something. Anyways, the subject is Paranoider Deutschmörder Kommt, K-O-M-M-T, in psychiatry, which must be so. And so I've gotten tons of these and stuff about Dresden and all that. If you've missed some of the show and you want to hear more of it, it's going to be repeated tomorrow on at radiopower.org at 9 a.m. and 6 p.m. RadioPower.org is the place to go. And then it's archived at WhiteRoseSociety.org. WhiteRoseSociety.org. And these people, and particularly the webmaster, Ben Birch, have been so instrumental, along with folks at RadioPower.org, in helping all the left talk shows across the nation in getting expression on the internet and archiving our shows. So I support them 100%. WhiteRoseSociety.org is having a fundraising drive necessary. I'm going to send them some money. If you utilize their services, think about giving them a donation. Now, I once had a consultant listen to my show, and she said, well, you know what you need to do is you need to sum up. When you come back from a break, you have to sum up what you were talking about. I said, I can't remember most of the time. I'm raving. I'm usually just raving. And I don't mean to say that they're incoherent or what have you. I mean, remember, we were talking about what's happening to the economy, the fact that it's come out more and more through this memo that Bush had planned to invade Iraq in early or in mid-2002 before it was even announced to the public. I mean, they announced it before the 2002 elections because his popularity was going down. But, and I was talking about the cons, right? The conservatives, they con you. So that's a good name for them, the cons, the conservatives. And I was just saying how they opposed the American Revolution, they supported slavery, they supported segregation, they supported all the wars, they were opposed to the civil rights movement, and some were Democrats. I'm not saying that. I mean, the Southerners were Democrats and conservatives. But as a philosophy, they want to conserve what is, no matter how terrible it is. If it's colonial rule, they want to conserve that. If it's slavery, they want to conserve that. If it's segregation and lynching, they want to conserve that. If it's wars, they want to conserve that. Essentially, all they're about control and power. And what do you do with control and power? You make more money for the people at the top at the expense of the people in the middle and at the bottom. It's that simple. But the shock troops, like Vincent, who wrote me at calltalkyes@yahoo.com, I don't even know what goes through their brains. I mean, they're just being taken for such a ride. They're such a pack of saps and suckers. And, here's what he writes. You're basing your condemnation of conservatives on two false premises. First, Vincent writes, that American conservatives of today oppose ideals such as those of the American Revolution and the abolition of slavery. Well, let me say this, that I would say that all conservatives support they say they support the American Revolution. I'd say that. I would argue that they don't support the ideals of it at all. But anyways, that they would say they weren't like the conservatives of that period who opposed the American Revolution. They'd say, oh, yeah, American Revolution is a great thing. The one revolution in the history of the world that they support. I mean, the conservatives were all against the French Revolution, the English Revolution, all of it. And second, that the drastic socialist changes you want to make to American society are in any way beneficial. So he's listening to this show. Vincent's listening to this show. And he's saying that the drastic socialist changes you want to make to American society are not beneficial. Where did he get this from? Remember at the beginning of the show, if those of you who are listening, I said I wanted to come up with some positive stuff because people are saying I'm just always being critical and the callers are always being critical and my website is just critical and all that. I said as long as, I mean, we're just on the defensive. I mean, we're trying to stop the middle class and working class standard of living from going totally down the drain. We're trying to, I mean, when you have GM and Ford declared that their stock is junk bonds, we're not talking about drastic socialist changes. We're talking about, can we, like, get back to the 1960s or something like that? Add something else, but let's just go on to our next caller. It's Roy is calling. Roy, hi, it's Peter Werby. You are on the air.
Hello, Peter, this is Roy down in New Mexico. How are you?
Well, from Placitas, right?
You betcha.
Now, how's that for a memory?
Like a steel trap.
Right. What's going on?
You're still not getting the feed when I'm on standby.
Oh, you can't hear it on the phone.
I'm coming in cold, but that's okay. I wanted to make a mention. The fellow that you're talking to a little while ago that was so misinformed, Rachel up in Santa Fe has a quote she's been using. Being misinformed is far worse than being uninformed.
Yeah.
Because you have so much more to learn just to get to the level of stupidity.
Now, which caller are you speaking about?
Oh, the guy that was blaming Clinton for everything. And, gee, it's not Bush's fault, because he just came in and he didn't know what was going on, and we just couldn't figure this out.
What's your take on it, Roy?
Well, I think he was totally incompetent. He had 9 months to get it straightened out.
Yeah, that was a bit.
He'd be making some stuff, and I heard your comments with him. The thing that I really called for, and I got a lesson in major media, if you will. Earlier this morning, with all of the hubbub about Rice going to Iraq, like that was a big thing. I mean,
yeah, she had a helmet.
So you jump on a plane and you burn a lot of jet fuel and you get put, you know, I mean, totally secure. What kind of hero is that?
Roy, I mean, she had to wear a helmet. I mean, things are that bad. The security situation over 2 years after Bush said mission accomplished, the Secretary of State goes to this this country and has to wear a battle helmet.
The thing is that on the CNN transcript this morning on the Internet, the very second paragraph was her statement about we didn't bring... Oh, man, now I got off track. But it boiled down to this war came to us.
Right.
That was the second paragraph in the first story this morning. I just checked it trying to find the quote.
Uh-huh.
It is 75-80% down a story that is five times as long. I had to use the find on my page to find that quote. It was so buried way down there. But again, they're lying.
Yeah, they are.
Since you used it earlier, I posted up on Tom Hartman's message board today, And the headline was, "The Lion Bitch."
Ooh.
And they're doing it. I mean, they're doing it, and they're doing it, and they're doing it. And that's why so many of these people still think that Saddam had something to do with 9/11. That's why so many people think that we found weapons of mass destruction, or they did such a good job of hiding them.
Well, you still think there's people, maybe there's a few, I don't know, can they be that dumb?
The last number I saw, Peter, was like 30-some percent.
Oh, well, you know, I've probably repeated 100% the Lincoln dictum. You can fool some of the people, you can fool all the people some of the time, some of the people all the time. Wait a minute, I'm getting that wrong, aren't I?
The people some of the time, some of the people all the time. All right. And 30% of the people all the time, and that's who you want to pay attention to.
Yeah, that's the sum of the people you can fool all the time. That's at 30%. And a lot
that's
of it is.
Base.
Yeah, and that's what Chomsky calls willful ignorance. And this is because this is the way they signal their allegiance to power. I mean, a little while ago, it was maybe caught up in the mass hysteria that was purposely created by Bushko. But now we're to the point that the only people that are saying that kind of stuff, they would say, I mean, whatever Bush et al. Would say, they would say that was the deal.
Right, so. And being up there in Motor City, I wanted to make one other mention, and I haven't had time to see it, but I heard a quick reference on the radio this afternoon that GM and Toyota were having some meetings, and I kind of thought there was going to be, you know, some, like, maybe some technology sharing or this or that, but the way that the news story read on the radio as I heard it was that Toyota is very, very concerned about a backlash because they're making too much money in the United States, and they're trying to develop something with GM to reduce their profits or take
What I'd be fearful of, Roy, is, I don't even know, fearful, is Toyota buying Ford. I mean, who knows? All right, I got to roll. Thank you, Roy, for calling in from New Mexico. When I was doing my national broadcast a few years back, we visited Santa Fe a number of times, me and Jolene Jordan, my producer and co-host, formerly broadcast on WRF, and Roy, we met him down there. Wonderful, wonderful part of the world. By the way, remember when we used to have all those terror alerts? They would always go up and down, and they'd say, "Oh, they're going to attack apartment buildings and bridges," it was the oddest things. They'd always get us all worked up about it. There was nothing we could ever do. You know, they'd say, "Remain vigilant, but go about your normal duties." I mean, what are you supposed to do? You go, I mean, even if there was no alert and I saw somebody kind of unloading explosives, I think I would intervene. But anyways, it turns out that the guy that was head of Homeland Security, Tom Ridge, here's what he said. This is from the USA Today. The Bush administration periodically put the USA on high alert for terrorist attacks, even though then Homeland Security Chief Tom Ridge argued there was only flimsy evidence to justify raising the threat, Ridge now says. He resigned on February 1st. He said he often disagreed with administration officials who wanted to elevate the threat level to orange or high risk of terrorist attack, but he was constantly overruled. He wanted to debunk the myth that his agency was responsible for it. He said, more often than not, we were inclined to raise it. Sometimes we disagreed with the intelligence assessment. Sometimes we thought even if the intelligence was good, you don't necessarily put the country on alert. There were times when some people were really aggressive about raising it, and we said, for that? So we were being hoodwinked again. And who do you think some people were? Who do you think some people were? Think they might have been in the White House? It wasn't deer in the headlights. They don't let him in on anything. They just let him bicycle around, even when all of the core of Washington is being put on high alert and sent out of the buildings. Now there's I should have got on this a long time ago because many of you emailed about me about this film called The Power of Nightmares, a series. It's a three-part series going to air on BBC in in England. And essentially it says that the threat from organized terrorism ain't there. It's a phantom menace. That the terrorism, organized terrorism, a phantom menace being used to mobilize society by the cons, by the neocons, right? And they say this also works for the Muslim extremists. In the Power of Nightmares, explores how the idea that we are threatened by a hidden and organized terrorist network is an illusion. And that this was that the conservatives and the Muslim extremists created today's nightmare vision of an organized terror network. The two movements, they, in their different ways, said they were going to rescue their society from decay. So that we had to be all mobilized, like in times of war. Like, keep saying, we're a nation at war. We're not a nation at war. And, see, this is really difficult. Because it's very possible that a small band of men, like, and there's not that many people that were even involved in all these terrorist networks, but enough to do great damage. And they really hit it lucky on September 11th. No one could have imagined that they would have had the success that they did. Maybe people could have thought a few hundred people were going to die, but the thousands were probably beyond the imagination of the people that planned it. And the problem is, I mean, I think this has been all jacked up way out of proportion, and all these, these mock terror tests, attacks and all that are just a lot of hooey. But individuals have the capacity, for instance, to secure nuclear weapons. Say there's 20 of them. Well, we're not at war with 20 men. You have wars against nations. It's not a war on terror. It should be a police apparatus to secure these people that are trying to act out their politics through mass murder. And we also should have an intelligence system and a preventative system that doesn't allow stuff like this to occur. In other words, what Bush allowed to occur on September 11th through inattentiveness, misfeasance, and what have you. But ultimately, this is correct, even if something else really horrible happens, that this is an illusion. And you say, well, wait a minute, didn't September 11th happen? Yeah, it happened. And something else awful may happen here or somewhere else. But that does not mean that the entirety of the U.S. Reason for existing has to be like we're at World War II, because we're not. We have to stop people from harming us and harming innocent civilians, and we have to have the intelligence apparatus and what have you. But the lengths that we've gone to are patently absurd and mostly done for political reasons. That's my opinion. 313-298-WRIF is our phone number, and boy, some of you have been waiting a long time. My apologies. Anthony from Wyandotte. Hey, you're on the air. Go ahead. Hey, Anthony.
Hello?
Hi, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Am I right now?
You're right now. Turn your radio off because we're on an 8-second delay.
All right, turn it off?
Turn it off completely.
All right, no problem. Hello?
Yeah, hi. Go ahead. You're on the air.
All right, I just want to thank you. I mean, I agree with like 95% of what you say, but I just want to know why I sit here, and you try to make people who agree with you feel stupid, you know?
Disagree with you, you mean?
You, hello?
Hello.
You try to make people who agree with you feel stupid.
Disagree.
You do?
No.
Well, you remind me of Bill Maher, because, I mean, I like your guys' show. Believe me, I do. But, I mean, you make us feel stupid and belittle us.
Wait. Hold on. You're saying if you disagree with me, I belittle you.
No, I agree with you.
But so how do I make you feel?
Well, it's just the way you talk. I mean, I don't know. I mean, maybe I sound stupid. I'm sorry. But
you don't sound stupid. And I'm not trying to. Wait a minute. If you agree with me, how can I make you feel badly? I don't understand this at all.
I mean, maybe it's like from watching Bill Maher, because maybe I associate you guys for no reason. But it's just like, you know, you guys sound so smart and you make so much sense. But you guys belittle people who watch sports and everything like that. Like, we're just white trash. We watch NASCAR and everything.
Wait, you are totally, Anthony, you are totally making this up. I mean, I never belittled anybody that watch sports. I don't care what people, it's up to them. But
I mean, you make people say, like, well, you know, like, let's forget about the real problems and, like, watch our NASCAR event. You know, maybe we do that for an escape. I mean,
I think escape is fine. I think that's what television is good for. What is not good for is gaining information about the world or making political judgments. But it is good for watching the Pistons, who even the series, of course, today against the Pacers. It's good for watching, I don't know, watching auto racing on television doesn't do much for me, but I don't care. That's, you know, it's not what I would watch. But watching dramas and what have you, that's what it's good for. The problem I have with television is the junk that poses as news and opinion.
Oh, I agree. Maybe I misunderstood you. I apologize.
No, it's okay. I'm glad. You know, I'll tell you, Anthony, if you felt like that, you couldn't be the only person listening. So, right. Yeah. And for whatever, if I sound smart, I'm supposed to.
You are. You are so smart. And maybe that's why I feel stupid, is because you are so smart.
You know what? It's sometimes people say, how do you know? My wife says to me, how do you know all that information? I say, I have no idea. I mean, I never finished college. Yeah, I'm not like a college graduate or anything. And all this stuff sticks in my brain, and that's what I do. I mean, this is what I do for a living, so I look at the Internet all the time. I have this website I have to do. So that's kind of my end of things. I mean, everybody has, I think, an obligation to figure this stuff out and have a source for this. But I'm not saying that you should have all of these facts in your brain that I do. In fact, a lot of the time, I mean, to be quite honest, I wish I didn't have it all in my mind.
All right, well, maybe it's just the way you come across me, because, you know, I admire you. You're, like, the smartest person I've heard, but maybe it's just the way you come across and say, like, well, you know, you can watch your sports and stuff, and maybe it just makes me feel stupid. I'm sorry.
Well, okay. Well, don't feel stupid. I appreciate you listening, and audiences are built, one person at a time, so you're important to me. All right?
All right, thanks, my brother.
All right. Thank you very much, Anthony. I appreciate your call. Here's Martin from Detroit. Martin, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air. Thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. Some open lines, too.
Yes, good program tonight. One strategy that I use when I meet someone who have a political conversation with them and we seem to agree, I always ask them to talk to their relatives in other states.
Really? What does that mean?
In other words, here in the Detroit area, a lot of people, and in Michigan, a lot of people vote Democrat.
Right.
Vote against the greedy conservatives. And I really think if the Democratic Party wanted to be strategic, they'd get a map and find the counties with a 50-50 vote.
Yeah.
And go in there and politely organize, not demonize the opposition, you know, just go in there and quietly organize and teach and recruit. Because I listen to your program every Sunday night, and I learn a whole lot of stuff, and I use it in conversations. But the point is, going after a few more percentage points. But the point being, it's in those counties, you know, where we can make a change. Somebody's relative lives out there, you know, and a couple more votes pushed in the correct direction could have a big influence.
Yeah, well, that's an interesting concept that actually the Republicans have refined. And their idea is if you can erode the Democratic base by just a few percentage points among people who have been their historic voter base, like trade unions or women or minorities, that you don't have to get like jillions of people. You just knock 1 or 2% off their vote total or get them to stay home. And you've got candidates, and look how close this is. Everybody, I mean, nobody has mentioned the word mandate for Bush in 2004 again. I mean, he got 50.8% of the vote. So another point and a half. I mean, that's a statistic dead heat. That Kerry ran an awful campaign, and there was a lot of reasons that Kerry lost. But it is, you're right, it was like 2 percentage points, one and a half percentage points the other way, Kerry would have won.
I attended a meeting where a Democratic base group was being pushed towards the Republican Party, and it was gruesome.
Yeah.
Terrible. They came out, and an old white woman came out and apologized for the fact her grandfather had been in the Klan, and then they moved on to beating up on Democrats for the next hour and a half.
Wow. I don't get it, but I think things are beginning to turn. Thanks, Martin. I appreciate you calling in from Detroit. 313-298-WRIF. And let's see, here's Patty and Taylor. Patty, you're on the air. Hi.
How are you?
Doing great.
Hey, got a couple questions for you.
Sure.
I take it you're not really a Bush fan.
Yeah, you got it.
Well, I'm a very patriotic kind of gal here.
Yeah.
I'm not too politically into the ways of the realm of politics.
Uh-huh.
But what I do know is, do you know where Bush was the day of 9/11?
Yeah, right. He was in that school in Florida.
He was in a class full of little kindergartners.
Yeah.
Okay, making an appearance for them. Don't you think if he knew 9/11 was coming, don't you think he would have had our men or our fighters, our jets, all of our weaponry, our defense system intact and ready to move?
Well, that's exactly what I'm criticizing for. I don't think he knew it was going to happen on September 11th. I think that there was enough evidence that there was going to be a terrorist strike somewhere in the United States, because there were memos about it and all, that there should have been some pretty heavy attention paid to preventing this and finding out what was going on. And there were all sorts of intelligence reports saying something was going to occur. There's this famous memo that said Osama bin Laden to strike in the United States, and Bush went off to Crawford, Texas. Then when he finds out, I mean, you know, he sits there for nine minutes, continuing reading this story rather than providing immediately springing to action as the commander-in-chief.
Okay, I agree with that part. But maybe he needed to make an impression on our future, as our future meaning those children. Okay, 9/11 was the most goriest, sickest thing that has ever happened to our country. Okay, the intentions of mass murder and chaos were intended to, threaten our country into chaos and retreat?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, they have failed. Our country is strong, and that's exactly what he says. But what kind of blew my mind is, instead of you being for Bush, it's like, okay, you got your little Taurus, but yet you want to go buy a foreign Honda to support the foreigners instead of staying with the United States.
I didn't say I was going to. I had a choice. Wait a minute, Patty. I had a choice between buying a Honda or a Ford, and I bought the Ford. For one thing, all these companies are becoming international. The Hondas are made in the United States. It's a little unclear, what you're even buying in terms of content these days. A lot of the Ford probably was made in Mexico, you know, different parts and all that.
I guess the difference between your thought of it and my thought of it is, I'm extremely patriotic, and I believe our colors don't run, and we didn't run, because you know how many men were in line waiting to go fight this war because of the problems that we have continually had.
Well, it's going the other way now. I mean, I don't even understand slogans like that, these colors don't run and all that. I mean, that doesn't do anything to try to figure out what's really going on. And right now, none of the branches of the service can even fill their recruiting quotas. So I don't know whether have problems we have to deal with, and like I said, they should be dealt with without making political advantage of them, and that's exactly what Bushko has done. All right, Patty, I got to go. Thank you. Why did I want to just read this? Last 2 weeks ago, someone called in and said that they had heard that immigrants don't pay any taxes for 7 years. Clayton from Farmington Hills writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. The myth I've always heard, and maybe what the original statement referred to, is that immigrants who start their own businesses don't pay taxes for the first 7 years. I've heard people say that after 7 years, they can sign up the business, they can sign the business over to another family members, and then they get 7 years more, etc. I think the myth was that it was only for Middle Eastern immigrants. Can you help clear this up? I'll tell you, Clayton, and others. And I suspect others of you have said that this is hostility towards immigrants. This is the first I've heard of this. And I can tell you without the slightest fear of being contradicted, this is absolute nonsense. And part of the way that, rather than, again, what I was saying to our last caller, rather than deal squarely with what's happening to the economy, starts becoming the fault of immigrants. And immigrants frequently throughout American history have been seen as the root of problems. At one time it was the Irish. Irish were the big boogeyman in the 19th century. There was signs saying no Irish need apply for new jobs because of, you know, they were thought to be not good people to hire. But whenever you hear something like that, immediately your radar should go up. I mean, it sounds like it has, just from your question. All right, we'll be right back with our final segment.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Detroit's Rock Station 101 WRIF and WRIF.com bring you the hottest deals in the Motor City. At WRIF.com, you are only one click away from dining at some of your favorite restaurants for only half price. Dine online and eat for less. Save a ton of money with some of Metro Detroit's best restaurants, like the Shark Club on Ford Road, just east of Canton Center Road in Canton. Log on to www.wrif.com. You can purchase full-price gift certificates to area restaurants for only half price. But quantities are limited, so you better act fast. For more details, log on to WRIF.com and be sure to check out even more special offers and savings. Like Buddy's Pizza, come into any of Buddy's 9 locations today. Enjoy one of the nation's best pizza places as recognized by the Food Network. Buddy's, Detroit's number one pizza since 1946. Log on today and save at WRIF.com.
Bill Bonds, get a pencil. Couple of questions. How's the world looking to you? How do you see things? A little fuzzy, a lot of squinting going on. Baby blues need a little springtime tune-up. Well, meet the Bonds Family Eye Doctor. Phone 877, then the letters U-S-E-E-M-O-R-E. 877-U-C-M-O-R-E. Dr. Combati is the man. The Lake Laser Eye Center, the most modern, high-tech, state-of-the-art optical procedure equipment ever made. Procedure virtually painless. Faster than you can blink an eye. You're in, then you're out. No more fuzzy, hard-to-read street or freeway signs. 877, you see more. How good is Dr. Combati? Well, my wife's baby blues are so good now that she can see through me. 877, you see more. Dr. Combati is the doctor. And when it's done, you're going to tell everybody you see, man, why didn't I do it years ago? Oh, by the way, you can jump on the net, ucmore.com. Bill Bonds, I'll see you.
Time is running out. Time is running out on the best deal ever on your opportunity to make an investment that can help you make more money and that will change your life forever. Time is running out on your chance to register for Oakland Community College's spring 2005 semester. Final walk-in registration for spring classes is May 5th and 6th. Register on the web or visit any of OCC's 5 convenient campuses to sign up for your choice of thousands of day, night, and weekend classes in literally hundreds of subjects like business, psychology, computer information systems, physics, English, pre-engineering, robotics, and more. If you want to take a giant step to a better life, Oakland Community College is your educational answer. Call or visit your local OCC campus now. They're in Auburn Hills, Waterford, Farmington Hills, Royal Oak, and Southfield. Remember, final walk-in registration is May 5th and 6th. Oakland Community College. Get anywhere from here.
Classes begin May 9th.
Like what you hear on the Riff? Then why not get your Riff Rock to go? Download all your favorite Riff tunes right now with the Riff Music Store online at WRIF.com.
Riff Rock. Rocks.
This is WRIF.com.
RiffRock.com.
Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much. Our last segment up at 1 a.m. Eastern Time. We're going to be airing a couple of interviews. One with Marcus Raskin. Marcus Raskin was in the National Security Council of John Kennedy. So this guy's been around a while. And he was also the founder of the Institute for Policy Studies. Got a lot to say about the direction of our democracy. And then an interesting book on the effect of American consumerism in Europe. Someone who I interviewed earlier in the week. Writing into calltalkyes@yahoo.com, Christopher's listening in Kingston, Tennessee, and he says, I like your show. My question is, when Bush wanted Saddam Hussein's son killed, and we paid out $50 million for their death, where did that money come from? Well, I think you know, Christopher, it came from our tax dollars. I always thought about that. Remember, they had that $50 million, what would you call it, bounty on Saddam Hussein's son. And I'm thinking, wouldn't these people do it for $1 million? Wouldn't somebody drop a dime on his sons, who were roundly hated and some pretty brutal characters? I mean, they were okay when Bush 1 and Reagan were supporting him, but you know, by now they were pretty well, not in the top 10 of well-liked people. Number one, top feared. But any event, so we put out $50 million of our tax dollars, which did, really change things, didn't it? I guess it really didn't. Wait a minute, why did I just do that? I just blew off somebody who, where were they listening? They were listening, and it was Peter in Florida. Okay, here it is. Peter is listening in, what city? Tallahassee. And he says, not sure if you have toll-free line, so I'll write. We don't have one, because this is essentially supposed to be a Detroit show, Detroit-based show. Well, that's what's turned out to be a Detroit-based show. So now it's going all around the country, all around the world, and love all you folks. But no way in the world are the people here going to spring for an 800 line. Anyways, as he said, is it possible to bring charges against George Bush and his staff after he's no longer in office? Or are they immune to prosecution after they leave office? I don't know. I think probably they could be prosecuted. I mean, if they're not being prosecuted now or impeached, and the fact that these memos are out showing that Bush lied completely about Iraq, I'm not sure what would be the crime that they would be prosecuted for. Here's Scott in Roseville. Let me see. Wait, hold on here. Yeah, hi, you're on the air. Is it Roseville?
Yeah, Roseville.
Okay, I got a misspelling here, but go ahead.
Yeah, I've been listening to your show, and you were talking earlier about the economy, and I'm one of them that's had to take a lower-paying job to just to get by. I mean, I've been an electrician for 11 years, and now I'm a bouncer in a adult club.
Yeah, you know, here some people going, "Duh, I'd rather have that job."
Yeah, it's not as glamorous as some might think.
I'm sure.
No, but the last week we had a bunch of people from the Homeland Security in town, because they have the All-Star game coming up and the Super Bowl coming up.
Right.
And I tell you, after meeting these guys, they're supposed to be protecting us from the terrorists. I'd like to know who's going to protect us from them.
Why? What was the problem?
They were very rude, very obnoxious. And they did spend a lot of money in the bar, but that was all on the government card.
Yeah, you and I paying for it.
Yeah, it's interesting to see where our tax dollars are going to protect us. You were talking earlier, too, about how a lot of people think you're too critical and stuff, and And with my recent experience with the career change and all that, it's critical thought, in my opinion, is what's really necessary to motivate us to, you know, overcome these things that are facing us.
Now, I agree. Let me ask you something just about when you say you're an electrician. Now, I hear ads for the IBEW, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. It sounds like they're always advertising for members. What's the deal with getting in the IB?
I'm not really sure why they're advertising, because I know a couple of guys that are involved in that, and they have like 1,200 different people waiting for jobs right now.
Yeah, you know, what am I saying? One of my good friends is on layoff, and he's a union electrician, and he's saying that he'll probably have to work like in Flint, or what did he say, Flint or Monroe?
Right.
So, like, right now, you what's the entry level? Journeyman, is that where you or apprentice? Which comes first?
Apprentice.
Apprentice. I mean, so you can't sign on as an apprentice electrician, huh?
No. I'm a journeyman electrician.
All right, so you're already there. Okay.
Right. But the problem with the union is if I join the union, I become a Book 3 electrician, and, you know, Book 2 electrician are journeyman electricians from other states that can come in and get jobs before I will. And then there's Book 1, who are actually the electricians who went through the union apprenticeship program.
Mm-hmm.
So even if I could join the union, I'm still going to be, you know, just barely above an apprentice.
Wow. And, you know, so what do you, you know, on one hand, when hard times come, people, it happens to them as individuals, but what happens when you see the larger pictures, when people are beginning to, and I don't mean to demean anybody, I hope you realize it, but begin to scramble for crumbs, you know, I mean, how
right.
can, and why is that happening in the wealthiest country in the world? I think that's the first critical question we have to ask.
Right.
There's enough money here to not have anybody suffering what so many people have, and to help other people around the world. Instead, things are getting worse and worse.
Right. Yeah.
Well, I hope things improve. I don't know what to think.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, I know some people have starting to. About 30 years ago, people began streaming out of Detroit and Michigan. And going to Texas, where they thought all the jobs were, like in the oil industry and what have you. I wonder if we're going to start seeing people leaving here.
That's funny, because back in the 70s, my dad took us all down to Texas for the same reason.
Really?
Yeah, and we were there for a year and a half and came back. But right now, I've been considering it, and I know at least four other people, you know, four other electricians are considering moving to Las Vegas because they have a lot of work down there.
Yeah, and I know relatives of my wife who've been out of work in California for like a year and a half and doing, highly trained computer programmers who have been working as security guards. That's who I was talking about earlier. They're moving to Phoenix, you know. And so, of course, what happens in those places, then it starts loading up with job seekers. Man, this sounds like, we're going to start singing those Depression-era songs soon.
Right.
You know, though, I maybe where it is, where you are in the class structure, my wife and I and some of her family and some friends and I went out to Birmingham today, and where they had a parade. And you say, wow, everything looks wonderful there. You know, I mean, maybe it's just where you're sitting in the world. All right,
right.
Scott, I hope things improve, but at some point, it's, you know, well, let me say this. That's just kind of a nice way to end a conversation. If we're depending on hope, we're not, that's a pretty, I mean, sometimes it's a generous emotion in terms of expressing it, but it's a little hard to really ride on. I mean, we've got to find someone, and might have turned out to be us to do things, to change things.
Right.
All right. Go ahead.
Have you ever read anything by Harry Brown?
I have. I'm not impressed with, I don't get all these people mad at me. I'm not real impressed with the libertarians, in fact, but whatever.
Well, I read a couple of his books that he wrote long before he became a libertarian, And one of them in particular was why government doesn't work. And just to sum it up real quick, it's, you know, the basic flaw with government is it's a coercive organization, that it's not meant to be benevolent like they try to portray it. It's basically, you know, rule by force.
Well, yeah, wait. I mean, see, there's kind of two aspects to my personality, well, not my personality, but really my political perspective. I mean, sort of in the realm of what's possible today. I mean, I sound, that's why some people say, oh, you're a liberal. I mean, ultimately, I'm an anarchist, and not in the sense of bomb throwing or violence or anything like that, which I oppose,
right.
But really the understanding, as just as you said, that government arose as a racket and was always based on force, and that ultimately government is what they say is a body of men with arms to enforce its rule, and it's always the rule of the wealthy and the powerful over the rest of us. It can be,
right.
It can be, and that's 99% of the governmental experience since it arose as an institution 4,000 or 5,000 years ago. You'll find some places that have, that are wealthy and, like, you know, the northern tier countries in Europe, Sweden and Denmark and Finland and places like that, where they actually do take, take great portions of people's wealth and then redistribute it for the greater social good. And it's not bad. I mean, it works out pretty well there. But again, that's an unusual set of circumstances.
Right.
So, you ready for the anarchist revolution?
I'm waiting for it.
Well,
I've been kind of promoting it on my own.
I'll tell you what. Where was I reading or writing about? Oh, I was just reading a little book, which is not really relevant to it. But if you can find stuff on the anarchists during the Spanish Civil War, and the revolution that they brought about, and the way they lived, and George Orwell wrote 1984.
Right.
He wrote this book called Homage. You know, it looks like to Catalonia, which is this area in Spain. That gives you a little brief look at the way it was. But there's some, I'm trying to think what would be. Can't even think off the top of my head would be a good book. But people can do it, and they are capable of living without government right now. The kind of life without, when Bush and them talk about life without government, they just mean government without any protection for the common people.
Right.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
All right. Thanks.
Appreciate your call. Hope things work out better. Is there a next on here? Well, let's get the man that's been waiting the longest. Ron, hi. It's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
Yes. Yes, I have two statements, pretty much. One of them, I think one of the problems we have is a lot of people, they support destructive activities and people.
Uh-huh. Like how?
Yeah. They support Bush, and they support the wars. And one of the reasons why they might support Bush is not necessarily, I think, is because they feel like a daddy, like a syndrome or something. It's because they see these actions, which he's doing, and they're thinking, okay, good.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. And so what I think is that unless we get these people out of government, they're going to continue doing, things are going to get worse and worse because they're just going in one direction.
Well, I agree with you. And ultimately, I mean, we say that Bush is horrible or other people say Clinton's horrible or whatever. But right now, for the last 5 years, there's great masses of people that oppose what's going on. And yet, we have not developed the movement, or I was going to say organization, but the movement to correct things. A movement with a vision that first begins a resistance to what Bushko is doing, and then secondly, has a vision of how we really want to change things so it works for everybody and not just a privileged few. That's important.
Exactly.
All right, I know you've been waiting a long time, but I'm actually near the end of the show, so I got to make this a little quicker than I would have. So thank you, Ron, for calling in. You know, in terms of personalities, not like these personalities are irrelevant, but anything, people will do anything that's socially permissible. Right? It makes sense. Like if we announce we're going to have concentration camps and we're going to start eliminating a whole sector of the population because of their, you know, was religion in Europe, and it could be religion here, or it could be race or something like that. There'd be people lining up wholesale to be the concentration camp guards, exterminators, or what have you. I mean, probably 90% hopefully 95% of it wouldn't do it, but 5% of the population is a lot of people. So what happens is that these twisted personalities are allowed to flourish, to come to positions of control. Now, Philip K. Dick, I've mentioned this before, so I'll do it quickly. Philip K. Dick, a science fiction writer, a late author, who wrote the basis of the book of, what the hell, I can only think of the real name of it, Blade Runner, that was the movie, and also an Arnold movie, which I can't remember. We Can Dream It For You Wholesale, Total Recall. All right. He had another one called, what was it, something like Phases of the Alphane Moon. And so they land on this planet, and it's just filled with strife. Sounds like the world today. And then you come to find out that this was the whole planet was like a mental institution, and that the paranoids became, I can't remember what, like the politicians and the super aggressives became the military, and on and on like that. But here, this I thought was interesting. This was a column in the New York Times, at Tipping Point. The reality is that sometimes the characteristics that make someone successful in business or government can render them unpleasant personally. What's more astonishing is that those characteristics, when exaggerating, are the same ones often found in criminals. Now, this guy did this, he says, what's his name? It's a woman, Belinda Board, training from London. There's been anecdotal and case study evidence suggesting that successful business executives share personality characteristics with psychopaths. The question is, are the characteristics that make up personality disorders fundamentally different from the characteristics of extreme personalities we see in daily life, or do they differ only in degree? Well, essentially, he says, they differ only in degree. The business population was as likely as the prison and psychiatric population to demonstrate the traits associated with narcissistic personality disorder, that is, grandiosity, lack of empathy, exploitiveness, and independence. In other words, they're not going to let anybody tell them what to do. They're also as likely to have traits associated with compulsive personality disorders, stubbornness, dictatorial tendencies, perfectionism, and an excessive devotion to work. So we're being ruled by nuts. That's the way it goes. All right. Stay tuned for our interviews. Thanks for listening. Thanks for calling. And if you've just joined the broadcast by virtue of reading the Night Call ad in the May 23rd edition of The Nation magazine, glad to have you.
WRIF.com.
If you think it's too late in life to earn the college degree you want, listen to this. Now you can go to a college designed for busy working adults. It's University of Phoenix, the nation's largest private accredited university. In most cases, you can earn a bachelor's or master's degree in just 2 to 3 years. To find out how, call 1-800-664-1391. At the University of Phoenix Detroit campus, the small classroom settings are designed for working adults with busy lives. With their efficient learning model, you'll cover more material in less time, going to convenient classes in the evening or on the weekend. At University of Phoenix, you can do this. For a complimentary brochure on degree programs in business, technology, nursing, education, and more, call University of Phoenix now, 1-800-664-1391. Programs vary by campus. Classes are forming, so call now, 1-800-664-1391. That's 1-800-664-1391.
Bill Bonds, get a pencil. Couple of questions. How's the world looking to you? How do you see things? A little fuzzy? A lot of squinting going on? Baby blues need a little springtime tune-up? Well, meet the Bonds Family Eye Doctor. Phone 877, then the letters U-S-E-E-M-O-R-E. 877-U-C-M-O-R. Dr. Combati is the man. The Lake Laser Eye Center, the most modern, high-tech, state-of-the-art optical procedure equipment ever made. Procedure virtually painless. Faster than you can blink an eye. You're in, then you're out. No more fuzzy, hard-to-read street or freeway signs. 877-UC-MORE. How good is Dr. Combati? Well, my wife's baby blues are so good now that she can see through me. 877-UC-MORE. Dr. Combati is the doctor. And when it's done, you're going to tell everybody you see, man, why didn't I do it years ago? Oh, by the way, you can jump on the net. UCMORE.com. Bill Bonds, I'll see you.
Detroit's Rock Station 101 WRIF and WRIF.com bring you the hottest deals in the Motor City. At WRIF.com, you are only one click away from dining at some of your favorite restaurants for only half price. Dine online and eat for less. Save a ton of money with some of Metro Detroit's best restaurants, like Shields, ideal for business lunches and family dinners, with locations in Southfield, Troy, Dearborn, Commerce Township, and their newest location in Warren. Log on to www.wrif.com. You can purchase full-price gift certificates to area restaurants for only half price. But quantities are limited, so you better act fast. For more details, log on to wrif.com and be sure to check out even more special offers and savings. Like Buddy's Pizza, come into any of Buddy's 9 locations today. Enjoy one of the nation's best pizza places as recognized by the Food Network. Buddy's, Detroit's number one pizza since 1946. Log on today and save at wrif.com.
Take to the ice with 101 WRIF and Labatt Blues 21 and over Summer Hockey Challenge. Games run in June at rinks across Detroit with a 3-game guarantee. All skill levels are welcome. More info available at WRIF.com or call Suburban Training Center at 248-888-1400. Get hockey with Labatt Blue and 101 WRIF.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
More Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. A pleasure to be with you. I have somebody I want to bring to our microphones who has so many credentials, who has had such an incredible career over the last several decades that it would take, in a way, almost too long to spend a lot of time doing that. Let's just introduce him as Marcus Raskin. He co-founded the Institute for Policy Studies in 1963 and also was a member of the National Security Council staff in the Kennedy White House. He is the co-author with Carl Levan of a new book, In Democracy's Shadow, The Secret World of National Security, something that obviously we're very concerned with during this era. Marcus Raskin, welcome to the Peter Werbe Show.
It's my pleasure, Mr. Werbe.
Let me ask you this. Let me take you way back to the founding of the Institute for Policy Studies in 1963 and your membership on the special staff of the National Security Council. How did those two things play out together?
In 1961, I joined the staff of the National Security Council, actually April 17th, which was the day of the Bay of Pigs. And I was asked to join by Mac Bundy, who was the special advisor, the special assistant in charge of the National Security Council at that point. I worked on questions of disarmament and other associated questions, even at one point civil defense and general issues of national security. At that time, the issues at the country revolved around nuclear weapons and nuclear weapons and disarmament, which was a great interest of mine. And it was something that kept me up, frankly, day and night, out of fears, because so many, in my judgment, so many dangerous roads could be taken and were taken, which would adversely affect not only the United States, but the world. There was a second piece to this, of a kind of a structural kind. My view was that the major questions of the time were moral and moral and political. They were not administrative and managerial. And in the government, most questions are framed in terms of power, administration, and managerial questions, which in fact turn out not to be able to get at more fundamental issues, which is what I was very interested in getting to.
Marcus Raskin, had you been on the National Security Staff prior to the Bay of Pigs invasion, would you have had different advice other than what occurred?
Yes, I did have different advice. Several days before that, I had suggested that it was a mistake to send the Cuban exiles into Cuba. The Brazilians had put forward an idea, which was that they would mediate the differences between Castro and the United States, and that was turned aside on the grounds that the Cuban expedition would be easy to do. And, of course, it didn't turn out to be very easy indeed.
Mm-hmm. Now, you certainly, in all the work you've done through the IPS and through, for instance, you've served as the advisor to the Episcopal Union Bishops, co-chair of the Issues Commission of the Progressive Alliance, and served as a member of the Presidential Commission on Education. So the labels are always tough, but this, I'm sure, would put you on the left side of the spectrum. Did you share the idea that was in the forefront of the Kennedy administration policy towards Cuba, that the revolution at that time was illegitimate? I know there was a whole sections of the left that were very happy about the Cuban Revolution.
I went to Cuba twice, in 1972 to 1979, and I did not like Cuba at all. Now, when I say that, that's a very different point than attempting to compose differences between one sovereign state and another. As you know, the United States has had a problem with Cuba since the early 19th century. It really sees Cuba, like the mafia talks about it, as a stone in the foot of the United States. And it's about time that we got over that.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was really my view, that it was time to, in fact, move along and go beyond worrying about what the Cuban government was doing or not doing. Now, the United States instead, then and afterwards, took the position that it would rather throw in with certain characters in Latin America that really were basically committed to a situation in which they would be clients of the United States. But the problem with clients is that they don't always stay clients. And that at that point, what happens is that they, so to speak, bite the hands and feed them. And this has happened over and over for the United States. In terms, though, of the general question of Castro's Cuba, there's one other point to be made. What he was able to do, or what the Cuban administration was able to do, in terms of health policy and education policy, cannot be taken away from that government. What can be taken away from it, and what must be taken away, is their human rights policy and the repressive nature of how that government has operated on and off over the course of the last 35 years.
Mm-hmm. Now, it's interesting. I went to Cuba in February, and I was very anxious to make some sort of evaluation given these often contradictory support and charges against that country, and came back without I loved being there. I didn't come back with a single piece of information that would have helped me on that. But I wonder, in your trip to 1978, 1979, you said you didn't like it. What did you see there that was distasteful?
Well, I have an aversion to situations which are closed. That is, where I have a feeling that people are not sharing free speech, they're not sharing civil liberties, etc. And I have a very great concern about that. Now, again, as I said, this doesn't go to the question of the significant accomplishments that they made over the last 40 years in the face of the United States having to bump off its leadership every which way, and causing embargoes and so forth and so on. But even that, there were certain things that just bothered me. And again, it was, a highly personal reaction. One way of thinking about such things is in an existential way. Could you ever see yourself living in that country? Mm-hmm. And my answer was no, I could never see myself living in that country. But as I said, that's very different than the question of what the relationship should be to another country, rather than the standard of, can I, in a subjective sense, be able to live in that country?
Well, I was reminded of this organization that I'm sure you remember as well, which was called the Soviet American Friendship League, which sent sympathizers of the Soviet Union during the 1930s, and who came back and said, gee, Stalin's Cuba was just wonderful, and I found it an absolutely wonderful, charming place, it almost devoid of politics, which made me a little suspicious.
Right. Well, on that, of course, there's very much on the part of people a will to believe and a will to disbelieve.
Sure.
And so one has to be very careful about, in effect, listening to people like that who have an axe to grind one way or the other. One has to be very careful, for example, about what refugees say about a particular leader, because indeed it may be totally reactive and mistaken, etc. And vice versa, to be very careful about such things as the Soviet American Friendship Society,
sure,
etc. But in that case, it's very interesting. Remember, it's very important that from 1933 to 1946, the Soviets were the allies of the United States, and they carried a bulk of the war with Hitler, in which some 25 million people were killed. So it made some sense, not a great deal, but it made some sense for people to say, those are our allies, and they're carrying the brunt of the war.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's do this because we're actually far afield from where I thought we were going. This all just came up as we continued talking with Marcus Raskin. And it probably is, this is a good point to begin talking about your latest book. And I'm thinking, since I mentioned the 30s, I was thinking of that mad psychologist, Wilhelm Reich, who said, don't look for fascism in Germany or Italy, look for it in yourself. And if we expand that to nations, I'm more interested, although I'm interested certainly in democracy and freedom and human rights everywhere, I want to begin with the country we live in. So you have co-authored the new book, In Democracy Shadow, The Secret World of National Security, and you talk about American democracy decaying. Now, that's a pretty strong charge.
Well, it comes out of several things. The history of the Cold War is a history of American military expansion and developing a state, a national state, to support that kind of expansion. That state includes constant and larger defense budgets, surveillance not only of others around the world, but of American citizens. It includes, in one way or another, the quashing or the guiding of dissent, both in the media and outside of the media. It includes also the use of the universities more and more into framing their courses, their decisions, in the context of national security. That's been going on. Since 9/11, my view is that that's greatly speeded up and is a very profound problem. Now, when you come to talk about fascism, I think that various nations have various forms of it. In the United States, the largest corporate units of the society, of course, want to deregulation, and the reason they want deregulation is they want to undertake the planning of the country without any sort of control from a publicly accountable body, and without any participation from such a body that might involve citizens, who supposedly are to accept the position of the market, which in fact is an oligopoly market, that is a controlled market of several large corporations. Secondly, you have going on now a strong grouping of people, not all of whom hold this view, but many of whom hold the view of the importance of religion as an instrument for patriotism, so that religion and patriotism end up being conflated together. And this conflation seems to, in fact, support authoritarianism both within the United States and abroad. And if you have a strong grouping of people, literally millions of people who have that view, then what you've got is the base for a fascist movement, or at least a pre-fascist movement. That would be better to state it that way.
Well, you know, this can actually kind of loop us around back to Cuba. If we dropped the names of the country and started talking about the social and political mechanism that each state apparatus uses to support its policy, mostly undemocratically created, you might get a little confused as to which you're talking about.
You would get confused. I think one would get confused because authoritarian states end up moving toward each other. The difference, though, of course, is that the United States is incomparably larger. And indeed, one way of looking at the United States is to look at the beginnings of the United States as a warrior state that expanded from the 13 colonies to a situation where it is now a worldwide superpower that has a thermonuclear weapons and so forth and troops all over the world. So that's a very big difference between the United States and Cuba. But what is not different is an attempt to guide various aspects of people's lives. In the United States, this comes as, in a very interesting set of forms. One is that, as Leo Szilard, the great physicist, said, the United States Americans have the capacity of freedom of speech because they've taught not to think freely. And that, it turns out, to be a very heavy charge, because it means that there is something wrong with an education system that is not critical, that does not allow us to ask questions.
Well, but wouldn't that be
true for Cuba?
Yeah, I mean, I was going to say, though, I mean, we're having this conversation, being very critical of the institutions that rule this society. There's all sorts of opposition speech. I did vote for John Kerry instead of George Bush. I can say that George Bush is a bum. So this would seem to give the definitions of a democratic society.
Well, the definition of a democratic society, in my frame, is falls into several views. Do you have the capacity to make the choices on the basic questions of the society? For example, who gets to decide, and how is a decision going to be made around nuclear weapons or thermonuclear weapons? Who decides on the question of war? Is it the people as a whole? Is it Congress? Or is it one man? And one can go through a whole series, a litany of questions like that.
Sure, the economy, too.
And you look at the economy and you say the same things. You know, Camus had a wonderful phrase. He said, well, the only power that the individual really had was the power to kick his dog. This was in The Stranger. I mean, he made that point.
Right.
He made that point, and it has to be taken very seriously, so that when you think about democracy, it's not just voting, which is a system of legitimation to accept the person who you didn't vote for. In other words, it's a legitimation of the system that you did get something, you know, you were able to vote. And, of course, if your vote didn't count, it doesn't mean much. But if your vote did count and you lost, you still went ahead with the system and accepted the judgment of the system. If, on the other hand, you're saying that democracy is both a means and an end, a means being how do you bring about social change, how do you develop the boundaries of what a moral sense is in the society, and what are the ends you're trying to get to, both near ends and the further ends, you come up with certain other ideas. One is you come up with the idea of access. Do I have, in fact, access to you and to others and to the use of the media? And here you are pointing out that's something that's very important. To the extent that that access closes down, to the extent that it's narrow, to the extent that television becomes nothing more than the flicking of my thumb, to find a station for one moment and I move on. That turns out to undercut the meaning of access, which then also undercuts the next idea, which is participation. Now, participation is a very important aspect to this whole thing, because in the old days, people participated in mobs. They used to participate in lynchings. But once you add to that idea that it's not only participation, but it's deliberation, that is the capacity to have a conversation,
mm-hmm.
to sit down and to talk and to figure out where the common consensus lies, why that's the common consensus, what the moral boundaries are, then you are on the way to having a democracy, a real one. And finally, then that relates to implementation. It relates to how do you put into effect that which you've decided. Now, that, of course, is the ideal way of looking at these questions, and it would take a very, very long time both to explain and have. But that's really, in my frame of reference, what democracy's about.
Well, I was going to say, Marcus Graham, excuse me, I knew I was going to do that. There's a wonderful man I knew, Marcus Graham, but we're talking with Marcus Raskin of the Institute for Policy Studies. Marcus Raskin was the co-founder in 1963, and he's the co-author with Carl Levan of the new book, which is Democracy's Shadow, The Secret World of National Security. And tell us the Institute for Policy Studies website, because this is where more of that conversation that we're having goes on.
You mean the website?
Yes.
Where you could find it?
Yeah, well, the Institute website.
Yeah, it's, what is it? It's www.ips-dc.
That's right. I should know this by memory almost.
Yeah.
And I'll have a link to that on my site, peterwerby.com. We have, let me see, only about 4 minutes left. A lot of conversation here will probably have to be abated. But you, as we said earlier, served in the Kennedy National Security Council, and you've written now the book Democracy's Shadow, The Secret World of National Security. How have things changed? I mean, certainly it seems that we had a few men, and particularly in 1962, the missile crisis that
yes.
brought us again to the almost the brink of nuclear war, and this was like a razor's edge of a couple of men deciding. Have things changed dramatically in the last 42 years?
You mean with regard to
secrecy?
No.
And okay, yeah.
No, they haven't changed. In fact, they're getting worse. There's the idea that there should be greater access to information of a very important nature, in which there's declassification of information, is not happening at all. And indeed, the reverse is happening. There's greater and greater control over information that the government is involved with.
Mm-hmm.
And this means then that there's a disconnect between the people's capacity to judge what's going on, or the scholar's capacity to judge, or the journalists who would act then, you know, as agents for the public. That can't happen at this point. So more and more of what goes on is guided news. For example, the so-called journalists who are embedded with various forces in Iraq is an example of guided information that one gets from the government at this point. And so the real question is, how do you go beyond that? To have a democracy. Now, there's one important point about that. Democracy is predicated, as John Dewey pointed out, on intelligence. But he was not talking about secret intelligence. He was talking about a collective intelligence of the people as a whole to be able to make proper judgments. And to the extent what you do is keep certain, or most things, secret from the people, and indeed use education as a means of guiding or propagandizing them, you're exactly destroying the possibilities of democracy.
I should say, in fact, we only have about 60 seconds left. I was going to talk about this. Marcus Raskin has an essay, Presidential Disrespect. So when I said I have the right to call George Bush a bum. That's in a long tradition of, you know, for better or for worse. I want to thank you so much for being with us. Marcus Raskin is the co-author of the new book, In Democracy's Shadow, The Secret World of National Security. And you can access that by going to ips-dc.org. Again, that will be on my website, peterwerby.com, W-E-R-B-E.com. Marcus Raskin, thanks for having joined me.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Every day, employers search for people skilled in today's technology. Are you ready for a change to a new career? Make a difference for yourself by calling the ITT Technical Institutes at 1-800-396-6622. Find out how an ITT Tech can help you prepare for a career in electronics, information technology, or drafting and design. Nationwide, thousands have launched technical careers after graduating from an ITT Tech. Classes meet just a few times a week to help you balance school and your job. Financial aid is available for those who qualify, and career assistance is available once you graduate. Now
Now's your chance to make a difference for yourself, to start a new path to a career involving technology. Find out what an ITT Tech education can offer you. Call 1-800-396-6622 for an ITT Tech brochure. Classes are forming now, so call ITT Tech at 1-800-396-6622. That's 1-800-396-6622.
Bill Bonds, get a pencil. Couple of questions. How's the world looking to you? How do you see things? A little fuzzy, a lot of squinting going on. Baby blues need a little springtime tune-up. Well, meet the Bonds Family Eye Doctor. Phone 877, then the letters U-S-E-E-M-O-R-E. 877-U-C-MORE. Dr. Kambadi is the man. The Lake Laser Eye Center, the most modern, high-tech, state-of-the-art optical procedure equipment ever made. Procedure virtually painless. Faster than you can blink an eye. You're in, then you're out. No more fuzzy, hard-to-read street or freeway signs. 877-U-C-MORE. How good is Dr. Kambadi? Well, my wife's baby blues are so good now that she can see through me. 877-U-C-MORE. Dr. Kambadi is the doctor. And when it's done, you're going to tell everybody you see, man, why didn't I do it years ago? Oh, by the way, you can jump on the net, ucmore.com. Bill Bonds, I'll see you.
Hit the great outdoors with the OSI Pro Series WRIF Fishing Championships. On May 28th, the series resumes with the Michigan Catfish Championship at Lake Erie Metro Park. Thousands in cash and prizes up for grabs, along with the title of 2005 champion. For more information or to sign up today, log on at WRIF.com.
Every Tuesday, get double shots of the best riff rock.
The way you want it.
Rock. See, I told you there was a rational explanation.
Super Tuesday on 101 WRIF.
Riff Rock.
This is WRIF.com. WRIF.com.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with another guest right after this.
Thank you very much for joining me. Pleasure to be with you. One of the things I hate to do is shop. You know, even that makes me a bad American because what's the economy all about? Consumption, right? Buying retail goods, big ticket items, and what have you. We joke about shopaholics and shop till you drop. And it seems like such a uniquely American idea, and to some extent it is, although commercial interchanges and exchanges have existed for hundreds of years, maybe even centuries. How does this work out when it goes to, in a sense, shopping to other cultures and to other continents? And obviously, American military might has brought itself to Asia and currently in the Middle East, but there's other ways as well. Joining me is Victoria DeGracia, and she is a professor at Columbia University, a professor of history, and she's written an intriguing new book entitled Irresistible Empire, America's Advance Through 20th Century Europe. Victoria DeGracia, thanks for joining me on the Peter Werby Show.
Thank you very much.
So I don't know. I mean, it took a long while till the Americans would think that the Europeans got up to speed with this shop till they drop. Has that ethos arrived in Europe?
Oh, it certainly has. Europe is dotted now with very big malls, and Europeans shop like Americans.
Well,
except that you can't always quite tell the difference, and there are big differences, and that's what my book is about. Getting from there, when the Americans first thought about selling abroad, which started at the beginning of the century, to very recently, when their Americans are faced with competition from Europeans and how to shop.
Yeah, I don't know whether you have that. That's odd that you say that. I mean, the beginning of the century, beginning of the 20th century, when I think it was a Senator Beveridge that said we must either have markets abroad or revolution at home. Is it that serious an undertaking, or is it just a way to?
It was very serious, in an idealistic sense. Woodrow Wilson, for example, he believed that people would get along in the world if they acted more like each other. So he, surprisingly, was one who said, go out and sell the American dream, you salesmen, and it will bring peace to the world. It will bring democracy, and with democracy, people looking alike, acting alike, there will be new ways of communicating with each other.
No,
so
we
kind of shopping for recognition.
Well, we only have fought Europe twice in the last 100 years, but I don't know. How does that work out as a thesis, Wilson's idea that if we all became rooted in a consumerist society and fairly equal would kind of solve a lot of the problems the world had seen?
Well, it doesn't work out, at least not that way. I mean, the United States advanced because of wars, and it was always carrying this sort of a double load. On the one hand, its enormous military power. On the other hand, this great vision of consumer democracy. But certainly, peace and consumption don't go hand in hand. It's a more complicated relationship.
Mm-hmm. Now, it's interesting about how much space there is for shopping and commodity purchase and what have you. When I was a kid, there was a you didn't find all-night stores, and if anything was open all night, was really suspect to begin with. There were a lot of laws in a lot of cities that forbid stores from opening on Sunday. Car dealerships, and I think there's still struggles around that here in this country, could only be open 5 days a week. And the other thing, I was just thinking this, is the idea that now everything is emblazoned with the name of a commodity, and we've all turned ourselves into bulletin boards or advertising, billboards for different commodities. So it really is, in the language that some people use, it is the triumph of the commodity here in America over most other cultural posts.
It's an enormously interesting problem. I think it can only be solved by studying the history. Now, when were we not this way? When were we not identified by being commodities? You know, how did it happen that in the United States first, when we began to get this commodity culture? Trace it to various ways. I mean, certainly the big corporations to sell their products directly to the consumer needed to invest in a big profile. And it's true, too, that Americans, because they were immigrant people, fell for using commodities as a way of identifying themselves as more or less equal or having a new pecking order or ways of getting into the society. So that combination of, big corporate pressure to make markets and a population which was very mixed and which could use these commodities to get access to power, little power, that combination was, let's say, a winning one in terms of the arrival of this commodity culture.
Now, how I think very frequently cultural critics, and I would include a book like Irresistible Empire in that, in my sense of things, see that this sort of mad consumerism, and certainly there's popular criticism of that as well, but see it as a negative, whereas many people, you mentioned immigrants, people that came in particularly in the earlier parts of the 20th century from Europe where they lived almost in peasant cultures, the idea to buy so much, and even today we're marked as how successful we are by, do we have 20 pair of shoes and 10 suits and 3 cars and 5 televisions. So it's, people, it's fair to join you and I, but from what I get from Irresistible Empire, we're critical of this, but most people think this is just wonderful to consume as many things as possible.
I don't think people really think that way. I think that there's been lots of forces to make people forget or to lose sight of other ways of spending their leisure time, other ways of spending their money, other values, which they have still, and they have had in the past. For example, the importance of leisure, which is not commodified, taking a walk, the importance of free time at all. This country has far less free time than Europe, and puts a very low value on having free time. The idea that you would that after all, education is a commodity, and books are a commodity, and the low value given to that kind of commodity, which in another culture, particularly the European, has more value, or eating well. Americans spend much less on food and on much poorer quality than the Europeans do. Still, and the Europeans dropped their spending on food and then increased it to pay more for quality products. And so these are cultural choices, and they're very much shaped by the politics around consumption.
My guest is Victoria DeGracia on the Peter Werby Show, and she's the author of Irresistible Empire, America's Advance Through 20th Century Europe. It's published by Harvard University Press. The subtitle, America's Advance Through 20th Century Europe. I was actually stunned in your book to learn some of these facts that I can't remember exact dates about that refrigeration in France was so low 50 years ago that there wasn't a supermarket in what was it, Turin or one of the Italian cities?
Yes, Milan.
Milan in 1954. Take us back maybe to the 50s. That seems to be kind of a pivotal time. What happens? When, or maybe I'm wrong, when did this America's advance through 20th century Europe begin?
I think you'd be right to say that the 50s is a real turning point. Probably we could start much earlier, the 20s. But let's stick with the 50s, because the 50s is associated with things we know about, the Marshall Plan, late 1940s. And that introduces not just American capital to rebuild, but introduces a game plan, a floor plan about how Europe, Western Europe, should look as it rebuilt. And it would be a place where there would be a model high standard of living in the American style, so that people would work hard, get their pay, not unionize if possible, not vote to the left, and spend their free time consuming in a set of nice goods, a radio, a nice white kitchen, appliances, the car. And so there was a very big American project at a time that Europe had been defeated, and many Europeans were looking for fresh models. And the American model certainly promised a way out of the terrible bads which Europe had been afflicted with, from, you know, communism on the one hand and Nazism on the other, the terrible poverty and which had led to so much class conflict in the years before. So 1950s is pretty crucial as the Europeans take off.
Well, most of us who have European roots, we always think, and I say this in general terms, think of the Europeans as sort of our benighted country cousins. Mm-hmm. In other words, we have big kitchens and big stoves and big cars, and they have little apartments with little stoves, and they have Citroens or you know, those little minis or what have you.
Yes, this is the American big complex. Everything big is better.
let me stop you. You say that jokingly, and I mean, I guess if someone said, "Would I?" And I have a relatively small house. My house, you know, for the Detroit area is 1,350 square feet, and as you probably know, the statistics now, there, you know, half the houses being built are over 4,000 square feet. That seems a little excessive, but the house that I have in a suburb of Detroit at 1,350 square feet would be like, you know, the getting up towards the upper middle class in a lot mm-hmm. of European countries. So there is some truth, I mean, that that bigger is better to some extent, or no?
Yes. I won't say bigger is better. I think, you know, our country is built with a whole different set of resources, huge space, initially a small population, lots of movement into the suburbs where land costs relatively little, lumber costs little. So it was possible to build this way, big, you know, single houses, large kitchens, bathrooms with windows. But what's so interesting is how that came to be transformed into the standard of living. When you could say Europe has a different set of resources. It had them, it still has them, and so what's wrong with that? But when the U.S. goes abroad, it tends to present its model of standard of living as the only way, mm-hmm. and its corporations tend to present it as the only way, and it's only when they're hammered and there are protests and they begin to lose profits do they make some changes. And then those are little changes that they make, you know. But McDonald's will add now some lettuce to its hamburgers in France, or redecorate the store a little bit. But the system, which is based on, you know, very wasteful use of resources, on you know, diets that are not very good, on ways of building housing, which demands air conditioning and heating and uses lots of water, you know, that isn't considered when it goes abroad, because it's profitable to think in the way that corporations think about in the United States.
Well, so much of it, of course, has been adopted by the Europeans, and I'm wondering what kind of cultural changes needed working there. I'm thinking that we're talking about the 50s. Well, you know, so many people, beginning in the 1960s, began watching French and Italian movies, and you know, the Jean-Paul Belmondo's, and thinking, oh, you know, Paris, how wonderful, which is true, it is wonderful. But on the other hand, Europeans are watching American movies, right?
Yes, and, yes, and they say, gosh, look at those beautiful objects, look at that telephone, look at that car with the fins. Look at the women driving around. You know, our women aren't driving around. Look at the way everybody looks the same. And for, you know, people who had suffered long poverty, workers who had suffered very long low status, the idea of people being equal, doing the same things, having these new fads which seemed to cross class, like chewing gum or, you know, wearing a baseball hat, like today wearing, you know, a T-shirt, that could be very attractive, at least for a while.
Well, what's lost here? I mean, I think that's what, I mean, there's what's coming across is this, at least this tenor of being critical of the invasion of American consumer culture into Europe. So they do gain what we have, a lot of objects, a lot of shiny stuff, more space, or at least the desire for it. And unfortunately, they haven't gotten into bigger cars very much. But what does Europe lose when they adopt these American consumer culture standards?
Well, there were, they lost a whole vision of a different way of living, a way of living that you know, had lots of protections, and that's lasted down to fairly recently. But it's being hammered away again and again. If you want, you know, a consumer way of life, then you have to abandon the so-called good consumption, that is, you know, free medical help, good social security, job security. So that, in the end, has been the trade-off that the Europeans have accepted more and more, that you know, the American-style consumer society, which is based on, you know, everybody earning their way and then paying for goods, some necessary and a lot unnecessary.
I suspect, Victoria de Gracia, that you've traveled to Europe extensively. Can I guess correctly?
Oh, yes.
Okay, all right.
lots of places.
And you, and I can tell just by that, you love Europe as well, right?
Oh, sure.
Okay, so is there, though, this romanticization possible? In other words, when we, you know, most people, when they go in vacation, even 200 miles, say, north in Michigan, and they go, you know, they go on a lake and they say, I'd like to live here all year round. I mean, in other words, we take for granted the kind of consumer culture that we have here. And then there is, so I guess that's my question. I mean, would as we were talking earlier, people do want modern stuff and they do want glittery stuff. Mm-hmm. So,
your question's a very good one. Are we setting up good Europe, bad United States, or do we do the reverse? Do we say good United States, bad Europe? And I don't want to do that. I say, look, let's look at the history and let's just face it now. The European standard of living is higher than the American. That is, the Europeans have all of the basic necessaries. They have the luxuries. They also have a very, very rich welfare state, and they also have a strong sense of community. So, you know, for now, anyway, you know, we have the Walmarts. The irony would be they're still at the Woolworth stage, which means they still have their main streets. They still have a much richer range of goods. They still seem to have some control over the notion of, well, what is necessary for a decent society where people understand who they are by the goods that they buy, that they're not going to invest in enormous and conspicuous waste. So I don't want to be a nostalgic. I don't want to be looking back. I'm looking to the present, where the European standard of living has exceeded that of the United States in the last 20, 30 years.
Well, I was just going to say, let me stop you there, because I probably, I mean, you know, this is a total guess. 20% of the audience probably said, what? The U.S. has the best standard of living in the world, and there's a famous multimillionaire right-wing talk show host that broadcasts from your city, and he has said famously that the poor in America live better than the middle class in Europe.
Oh.
Now, remember, you can't say anything.
I can't say anything nasty.
That's right. But actually, a guy has a book on the on the best New York Times bestseller list. It's about BS, and he says it in the title. But
right.
Go ahead.
He should take a nice trip to Europe.
Yeah.
And he should move around, and he should go into small towns. He should go into working-class neighborhoods. He should go with a German when that German worker comes out of the factory, and he takes a month's vacation in the seaside in Greece. Well, he takes 2 weeks in Greece. Then he goes for a couple weeks to the mountains. Working class people.
Mm-hmm.
You should go to England and see the kind of medical care that workers get. And I put these here. This is consumption. These are choices about consumption that are being made. And if you look at the way that the Europeans use their consumer power, it's very different from the way the average Americans do. Okay. They spend more on food. It's true. They spend more on vacations. They spend much less on medical health insurance, though they are very, very healthy. They live longer than the Americans now. Okay. They spend less on schooling, but they have good high schools and good universities, so their people certainly get good schooling. So a whole range now. And this is part of the decline of the American empire, which is what I end on, that we don't recognize that the middle classes and the working people of Europe now have a higher standard of living by most all categories, by most all statistics.
Hmm. The book is Irresistible Empire, America's Advance Through 20th Century Europe. My guest is the author, Professor of History, Victoria de Gracia. And it's published by Harvard University Press. Let's talk a little about the resistance that's come about in the last few years to the Americanization of European culture, where lots of it has been accepted wholesale. And as you said, there are shopping malls, and and now most people in France do have refrigerators, in fact. But I just quickly looked in your index of Irresistible Empire to see if Jose, did you say his last name, Beauvais?
Beauvais, yeah.
Yeah, Jose Beauvais. Beauvais, who famously ran a big bulldozer into a McDonald's that was being constructed in France. This is rather extreme, but there is a lot of resistance to the McDonaldization of Europe. And tell us about the slow food movement. I love that phrase.
Oh, slow food movement. Yes, it's strong in Europe. It's strong in the United States, too. So it's a new kind of movement. It basically says that the United States is not the problem, and Europe is not the problem. The U.S. isn't bad. Europe isn't good. What we need is a kind of a third way, you know, to think about what we're consuming, what we're putting in our mouths, to try to find, food that's good, but as a kind of culture of food. So it would bring together people around meals at home, outside. It would bring people in contact with the producers of food to try to get back and identify with those who are producing food. And they say it may be that we'll end up spending somewhat more on food, but then the problems of obesity, the problems of the kind of malnutrition that comes from so much processed food, the diseases like in Europe, mad cow disease, which are associated with genetically modified and poor fodder for animals, these would be the trade-off. So it's a very interesting social movement today, and it gets around sort of that old debate, shall we be very, very austere, or should we spend, that kind of old counterposition between Europe is good, America is bad, or America is bad, Europe is good.
Well, I remember the first time I was in Europe, I was on a bicycle trip, and we were in a small town in France, and I all of a sudden, around noontime, everybody disappeared. I mean, this busy, busy street, and it was gone. I'm thinking, what the hell am I? Is it aerators or something? And then, of course, everybody had gone home for lunch, and they were taking a two-hour lunchtime. What this gets back to about fast food and part of its popularity in the United States is if you got a half an hour for lunch, you better get some fast food.
You're absolutely right, and that's why McDonald's has become so popular in Europe, because it responded to what was already happening, that people were not able to go home anymore. So small stores of all kinds, even little chains, rose up, you know, to serve what in Italian they call the panino, or in France the baguette with a little bit of food. And, you know, so it moved into a niche that was already being created. And it comes down to what kind of movement it does. You know, it comes in like a big monopoly. It buys up all the little guys. Okay? So this alternative of, you know, a French fast food, let's put it that way, probably be a faster food, or an Italian faster food, that gets preempted by this big muscular McDonald's with its huge capital, and it's willing even to take losses in the first years that it sets up. So I think that's the story. You know, what could be the alternatives, and what prevents them from flourishing? And, you know, so it comes back to, you know, McDonald's is a huge power.
And Walmart, certainly. And
Walmart is going to be the same story as it goes in.
I've predicted that eventually there's going to be one corporation in the whole world. It's going to be called International General. And probably owned by the Waltons or their descendants.
Yeah,
but let me see. Oh, and this is so interesting. I've watched the time go away. We only have about 90 seconds left. I mean, who's your money on in terms of going to win another one of these culture wars in Europe? Is it going to be a mix, or are people going to resist the Americanization of European culture?
Well, one could be flippant and say that the Chinese are going to be the winners.
That is,
they're going to be the sourcers, certainly, of so much of the manufactured goods. The question will be, you know, who who designed the specifications for the Chinese. Both the United States and Europe are, you know, shall we say, declining relatively in the face of that. But Europe is not going to be to disappear. even if there's a Walmart near Florence, the consumer culture is still going to have a different quality. It's still going to support a, you know, a softer way of living, and the United States, you know, has real problems it's going to have to face is to revive its standard of living, because it's simply no longer a global model. It's no longer an acceptable global model, I think.
Well, thank you so much. Victoria de Gracia, who her book is Irresistible Empire, America's Advance Through 20th Century Europe. I'll have a link to it on my site, peterwerby.com. Thank you so much for having joined me.
Okay, thank you so much, Peter.
This is WRIF.com.
Bill Bonds, get a pencil. Couple of questions. How's the world looking to you? How do you see things? A little fuzzy, a lot of squinting going on. Baby blues need a little springtime tune-up. Well, meet the Bonds Family Eye Doctor. Phone 877, then the letters U-S-E-E-M-O-R-E. 877-U-C-MORE. Dr. Combati is the man. The Lake Laser Eye Center, the most modern, high-tech, state-of-the-art optical procedure equipment ever made. Procedure virtually painless. Faster than you can blink an eye. You're in, then you're out. No more fuzzy, hard-to-read street or freeway signs. 877-U-C-MORE. How good is Dr. Combati? Well, my wife's baby blues are so good now that she can see through me. 877-UC-MORE. Dr. Combati is the doctor. And when it's done, you're going to tell everybody you see, man, why didn't I do it years ago? Oh, by the way, you can jump on the net, ucmore.com. Bill Bonds. I'll see you.
If you think it's too late in life to earn the college degree you want, listen to this. Now you can go to a college designed for busy working adults. It's University of Phoenix, the nation's largest private accredited university. In most cases, you can earn a bachelor's or master's degree in just 2 to 3 years. To find out how, call 1-800-664-1391. At the University of Phoenix Detroit campus, the small classroom settings are designed for working adults with busy lives. With their efficient learning model, you'll cover more material in less time, going to convenient classes in the evening or on the weekend. At University of Phoenix, you can do this. For a complimentary brochure on degree programs in business, technology, nursing, education, and more, call University of Phoenix now, 1-800-664-1391. Programs vary by campus. Classes are forming, so call now, 1-800-664-1391. That's 1-800-664-1391.
Detroit's Rock Station 101 WRIF and WRIF.com bring you the hottest deals in the Motor City. At WRIF.com, you are only one click away from dining at some of your favorite restaurants for only half price. Dine online and eat for less. Save a ton of money with some of Metro Detroit's best restaurants, like Clubhouse Tavern, located in the fabulous Fisher Building, offering great food at great prices. Log on to www.wrif.com. You can purchase full-price gift certificates to area restaurants for only half price, but quantities are limited, so you better act fast. For more details, log on to WRIF.com and be sure to check out even more special offers and savings. Like Buddy's Pizza, come into any of Buddy's 9 locations today. Enjoy one of the nation's best pizza places as recognized by the Food Network. Buddy's, Detroit's number